This episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Scream Factory Home Entertainment.
Woohoo!
Now, we all love Scream Factory.
Yeah.
We've brought Jeff Nelson on the show.
McMillan.
We brought Cliff on the show. And Scream Factory is celebrating its fifth anniversary this year, guys.
Nice.
It's freaking
amazing.
Awesome.
Scream Factory has released over 250 of some of the greatest horror, sci-fi, and cult films ever made. There's something for everybody, I would say.
Yeah.
Wouldn't
Does
you agree?
Anybody out there have all 250?
Yeah.
If you do, take a picture.
I wish.
And I guarantee you, I want to believe there's one listener that does.
There probably is. And they have like a shelf that's probably like all
numbered,
the spines.
Right? They're all numbered. So. Yeah.
They're not.
Oh, they're not numbered.
No, but they match the spines because I remember Jeff explaining to me about how fans want to see like the line of Scream Factory logo. So they keep the spines the
same. Well, here's the thing about Scream Factory. Their catalog features some of the great films from John Carpenter, Wes Craven, David Cronenberg, Brian De Palma, and Tobe Hooper. Many in the collector's edition line are packed with extras and feature newly commissioned art. Some of the new releases they got coming up are Dead Time Stories, Firestarter, RoboCop 2, and Tales from the Hood, which I am especially looking forward to.
Nice.
Head on over to www.screamfactorydvd.com to see all that they have to offer, including some exclusives that they put online. So when you order their special collector's editions.
Was that Ryan Turek talking just then, or was that the ad?
I couldn't tell that last line. You actually got me. I was like, I don't know.
No, that was
the
not
goal of having sponsors all week is to make it feel natural.
That was natural. Does anyone remember the drug they used in RoboCop 2?
Nuke.
Yes.
Dude, man, that's
But wait,
so good.
Episode number and who are
welcome
we?
To Shockwaves, episode 39.
That's right.
I am your co-host, Mr. Ryan Turek. I am joined by Rob Galuzzo.
Yes.
Elric Kane and
wait, what?
Doctor?
What?
Rebecca McKendry.
I get sound effects before my name. Take
that,
suckers.
That was pretty good. Hey, Ryan bought us mugs and gave us alcohol.
We have the shock.
All right, guys.
Yeah,
so I tossed these up on Instagram because I got very excited. I bought my co-host some gifts.
I made some
Shockwaves mugs.
Yep.
That Elric is drinking whiskey out of right now. I'm drinking whiskey.
Wow.
Rob is drinking
water.
and Becca is.
I'm on LaCroix.
LaCroix.
No. I could have put it into the mug.
actively working on getting these Shockwaves mugs on Cafe Press so you can go on and order them yourselves.
Yeah, we're trying to get all that in line. Cafe Press, and I know Cavity Colors is in fact planning more shirts and enamel pins with the Shockwaves logo mid-March.
Yep.
That's, you heard it here first.
Yeah, things are pretty tight here at Blumhouse for Ryan, so he needs to make a couple extra bucks. So he's going to the mugs.
Selling mugs.
Because there's nothing. Nothing to do here at Blumhouse. Nothing to do.
Well, speaking of.
Yeah.
Hey, we had a big announcement this week, guys.
Let's talk about the big elephant in the room.
Let's put you on the spot, Ryan. You shepherded this, didn't you? This was a big deal.
Yeah, it was a group effort. I mean, like, it was a lot of Jason. There was a lot of my cheerleading.
Right.
You wanted it most.
Yes.
Halloween, baby.
And as did Jason, you know. I mean, like, you know, Jason came to my office and he's like, this is a great idea. I hope, let's get it. Let's do this. And I was like, I completely agree.
Where's the statue?
It took a while.
Do you remember that?
It took a while.
Jason said, Ryan, if you fucking get this, I'm going to put a statue right in the lobby.
Oh, man. We're going to have to look at a Turek statue when we walk in.
No.
Hopefully with his arms crossed, it's like, what's up when you walk into Blumhouse Productions.
He has to get Friday first, too. So you have both of them. If you do that, then you get a statue.
Epic win. 13th. Well, Halloween is a very exciting announcement. If you guys haven't heard, and if you haven't, where the hell have you been?
They've heard.
We've got David Gordon Green directing the next Halloween film, a Halloween film. I can't confirm or deny if it's a sequel, if it's this, it's that, whatever. I'm not going to be able to say it on the record. But David Gordon Green is going to direct from a script that he co-writes with Danny McBride, the Danny McBride, not Underworld Danny McBride, but the actor, producer.
Eastbound and Down. Yeah.
Now,
and they write all their stuff together for the most part, right?
Yeah.
It's
always
they went to film school point. Together, yeah. North
yeah.
Carolina.
Yeah. No, but they're fantastic. I think they're a great, great team. I mean, like, you guys got to remember, David Gordon Green came from a background in which he did these great indie dramas and thrillers. And, you know, I always see in the press, Pineapple Express, Danny McBride, and David Gordon Green is like, No. Let's not forget about the dramatic thrillers that he once committed to.
Gordon Green has a freaking Criterion movie out.
Exactly.
Pineapple Express came out, that was as big a shock to fans as announcing that he's doing a Halloween.
Right.
Like everyone was like, and he pulled that movie off.
Yeah.
So Your Highness is still, you know, some movies are going to not work, but I've seen all the art films they made, and they're all freaking great.
Yeah.
You know, Undertow was a lot of fun. That was filmed while I was in film school in Savannah. So they were shooting it, and they were doing talks at the school and everything.
The Real Girls one.
All the Real Girls was great.
All the Real Girls, I remember seeing that one.
The star of our favorite show of the year.
Which one?
The one with the teeth guy.
Oh, okay. Candle Cove.
Yeah. Yeah. He's the star of that film.
Yeah.
So he might appear. He could be Loomis for all we know. Who knows? Ooh. Even though Sam Neill already has the role. you can't quote anyone on that. But no, I mean, look, we are as a non-Blumhouse film, so you can trust me, I swear.
Yeah, you're the one who I want to hear this.
Even though
from.
Ryan bought me this mug, you can still trust me. I thought it was probably the coolest announcement I've read in a very long time, because the main reason isn't whether the movie's going to be good or bad. It's that there is zero ability to predict what the outcome is going to be.
Yeah.
And as a fan of surprises and good movies, it's like I can't go two steps down the road and go, oh, it's going to look like this. I have no idea what they'll come up with.
That's what's exciting to me, not knowing what it will be.
Yeah, totally.
And there's been, you know, and I know a lot, there will be a lot of theories. I saw like a fan petition to get Robert Englund doing something. And it's like, guys, let's just wait.
And also,
they're currently writing, we're working on it. It's going to be awesome. You know, I've been in many a meeting with the two of them, and, you know, Danny, I've said this on my Facebook page, Danny is such a horror fan. Like, he's such a horror fan. David Gordon Green is a horror fan.
Well, he tried to make Suspiria for years.
Yeah. No, I know.
Man, I was all for that.
And I think this is a better fit.
And FYI, everybody, Suspiria got done. Like, David Gordon Green didn't direct it, but they actually remade it. Yeah. It's in post. And,
for Amazon.
You
know,
the I Am Love director. I'm excited to see it, though, because from what I read, they were doing interesting things
with it. Well, it's an artistic Italian director, so that's actually a good fit. I actually think David Gordon Green's a better fit for this, because the realism of the world of all those movies he made, it was always about a place. Like, you could always feel the location wherever they shot.
Right.
That was the key thing about his films.
Yes.
And he used locals.
You're absolutely right. Oh,
and
no,
I
totally,
love that.
Totally.
And I feel like Haddonfield, the original film, has that same feeling. Even though it's Pasadena, it feels like a real place. And I've always loved that about Halloween. I think of all the horror films, that's the film I go back to if I want to feel a small town, you know, that feeling of environment.
Well, I mean, most importantly, I mean, like, it's about drama, you know? Mm-hmm. It's about solidifying those characters.
Right.
You know, I mean, like, I don't like reading, you know, it's like, oh, it's so easy. And it's like, no, it's not. It's not easy. You know, right. I mean, like, you could say that about Friday the 13th.
Yeah, Friday is a lot easier.
It is, but how do you transcend that? How do you, like, try to give you something more than just the cookie cutter stuff,
you know?
And these guys, you know, thankfully delivered so far something really cool. So very excited.
Yeah.
And I am excited for the fans to check it out.
Well, and the best is if John Carpenter's into it, which he sounded really genuinely excited, means like that's a lot more exciting to me, because then he might want to get involved with doing the music or be just more of an active participant.
Oh, Rick, didn't you read the comments? He's getting paid to say he's excited.
Okay. Well, if you live in that world of sadness and negativity, then, you know.
He doesn't have to say anything. John, if anyone's learned anything from John, he doesn't have to say anything he doesn't want to.
Oh, yeah.
Nope,
ever.
Nor does he at this point need the paycheck of saying a specific thing just to get an extra buck.
It's
ridiculous.
Funny.
Well, whatever. I'm excited.
New blood, baby. Get some new blood.
New blood
in the horror genre is never going to be a bad thing.
Yeah.
All right, let's see. In terms of things we've seen, before we delve into individual movies, did anyone revisit the My Bloody Valentine movies or Valentine-esque horror for Valentine's Day?
That is part of my,
It is. Oh, you want to jump right in, Ryan? I think I know which one, because I saw a little feud between you and Collins.
The feud. Which
called you a terrible human being for your review.
No, I think he just said you're a total fucking asshole.
Because
I watched Valentine. You know, it was funny because last year, you know, we did the double feature at your house last year of the old My Bloody Valentine and the new one this year. You know, my girlfriend and I had celebrated Valentine's Day already, and she was like, what do you want to do? I'm like, I want to revisit Valentine, which I have not seen since opening night in the theaters in 2001 at the Burbank 16. And I believe that is where I met Mike Mendez for the first time.
Oh, man.
Because we both loathed the movie coming out. And I heard him going, oh, it's terrible. And I had recognized him from Fangoria magazine. I was like, you're the guy who did The Convent. I'm a big fan. He's like, oh, what'd you think of that movie? I was like, it was terrible. He's like, me too. We're friends.
nice. And romance was born.
Exactly. Valentine, directed by Jamie Blanks, who did Urban Legend, which is a real doozy in and of itself.
Really? I remember, and granted, I have not seen it since opening night, but I remember liking Urban Legend.
No. Except for the end. Second one's better.
So bad.
The title. Someone should remake the freaking title.
Though. Oh, I know. Yeah. They should just use that as a property.
And make real Urban Legends.
Yeah. I think someone was going to try to do something like that. Yeah. But Jamie did do a movie called Storm Warning, which is actually
that's
pretty
cool. That's a cool one.
Yeah, Storm Warning
was good. And then he Cut as well. That,
what's that?
The Australian slasher film Cut as well. Where it was kind of Scream-esque. I think it was. I thought it was his first thing. I might be wrong.
Yeah. But Valentine, seeing it for the second time, just confirmed everything for me. That is the worst offender of all in terms of being a boring slasher film.
I just got a text from David Borean saying, fuck off. Sorry, Bor.
Well, the funny thing is that, you know, it begins with, if you guys don't know the story, it's about, you know, it's a typical, you know, kid coming back for revenge on a group of girls for wronging him when he was younger.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the beginning, you've got this really nerdy kid who's at a dance and, you know, he's asking all our main girls, being much younger, if they want to dance. He winds up going with the unpopular girl to dance, and then she turns her back on him in a cruel way. And you're like, oh, okay, that's the killer. Got it. And then you cut forward 13 years. They introduce Katherine Heigl. You're like, oh, here's our final girl. Nope. Nice little twist there. But then you get introduced to David Boreanaz, and you're like, oh, okay, I got it. He's that guy. Got it. So the rest of the movie, you're just sitting there watching these women get picked off. Women like Denise Richards, who's coming off of Wild Things.
Is that the hot tub death?
Starship Troopers? Yeah, yeah.
The hot tub death's pretty cool. I like
that. No, it's terribly choreographed. No, that's the other problem. Is the slasher, like all of the slasher kills are so terribly choreographed.
I mean,
that's what slasher movies are about. The Mask is great.
The Mask is good.
Yeah, The Mask was really good.
No. Who is it? Rick Boda, I think, shot the film, and he also did House on Haunted Hill, which is really beautiful looking. So he knew how to lit the killer. But, you know, it's like these slasher movies are all about the kind of build-up, payoff, and there's no build-up. The build-up sucks. So anyways, I started even, like, dozing off in the third act because I just didn't care anymore.
Wow.
Then I got up and I rewound, and I was like, oh, yeah, I didn't miss much. Great. And then the little twisty ending happens, and I was like, oh, got it.
Wow.
But that was part of a string of movies. I think in that post, I Know What You Did Part 2.
Yeah, because 2000, right? They always had like a group of young, good-looking people on the cover in a formation. And it was the neo-slasher, the new slasher, but they all kind of became more derivative as
I feel
they
like
went
it,
along.
It all gave birth to the CW what it is now.
Pretty
like,
much.
You know what I mean? Those movies turned to TV.
It was a weird cycle because it was Scream and the WB, you know, and on WB you had like Buffy the Vampire Slayer and stuff like that.
Dawson's Creek.
And then Scream WB gave birth to The Faculty Disturbing Behavior and all that stuff. And then as you were kind of coming out of the 90s into the early 2000s, it like WB turned into the CW. Yeah. You know, horror was shifting again. Everybody was getting tired of these kind of like cookie cutter slashers. And that was at the very tail end. I mean, like, I think Scream 3 came out before. Anyways, it was heralding the end of it, you know.
Yeah.
And Jamie Blanks, I mean, as a director, he was kind of like holding on with one pinky finger, you know.
He's still holding on. Somewhere.
Well, I will say this about Valentine, because I saw when it came out, didn't like it then. Yeah. I revisited not too long ago on DVD, maybe last February. And I thought it was better than I remember, but part of that is just the nostalgia for that 90s era, because now all those movies do have an aesthetic from the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing. It made me go back and buy the novel by Tom Savage that it was based on. And let me tell you, I'm sure he's just as angry. They literally just bought the title, and the novel is nothing like the movie.
Mm.
And the novel is fucking excellent. Mm. It is an excellent murder mystery slasher. And the only thing is I read it, and and not to give anything away, but the way in which they handle the killer, and it would be very impossible to adapt it properly without giving away some of the fun surprises.
That's
the difference between a novel and a movie, right, is that you can get away with a lot more in a novel because you're not physically seeing things. But I remember it being like one of my favorite horror novels that I've ever read and being bummed, and being bummed that there is not a movie based on that novel.
Yeah.
Instead, there's this crappy one that has nothing to do with it. So I don't know. It'd be fun. I wonder what the where the rights are to that.
Great Valentine title, too. Novel. I mean, if you have the movie called just Valentine or Valentine's Day.
Yeah, I recommend that novel. It's great. It really is. So, well, I saw My Bloody Valentine 3D. I'll just mention it briefly because I know a lot of people already watched it. And I actually like watching the 3D one first and then the uncut version of the original, which is how Ryan and I did it last time. But I showed it to our office manager here and a couple interns, and everybody seemed to have a good time with it. It's still fun. I mean, it's the only thing I'll add is that it has one of my favorite. The way it's written is very like it's very dramatic between this whole love triangle between like the two people that are potentially the killer and like the lead, or maybe it's Harry Warden, who knows. But it has one of my favorite moments that doesn't happen enough in horror movies, which I totally forgot about, which is basically the lead character has at gunpoint the two potential people that might be the killer, and then one of them is like, fuck it, just shoot us both. And like, what? He's like, no, just the only way to be sure, just shoot us both. And I just was like, I laughed out loud when I saw that again last night because I'm like, that's one of my favorite slasher movie, like undoing of a typical trope where it's just shoot us. And I'm like, that makes this movie worthwhile.
I mean, that guy had nothing left to lose. I mean, like,
at that point,
you know, he's just like, whatever.
What about you, Ark? What did you say?
I have one that was inadvertently a Valentine's Day movie, so I didn't plan on it. This comes from the great, if cast your mind back, Killer POV listeners, Darren Scott once came on our show.
Yes.
And he talked about pretty much his favorite movie, and it was one of the few films by this director I hadn't seen. Couldn't find a good copy from then till now, and it just popped up on Shudder.
Oh.
It might have been there for a while. This film, Christian Grey, Eat Your Heart Out, because while you guys were doing mommy porn at the theaters with, Darker?
50 Shades Darker.
I was watching the original Christian Grey, which is Christopher Lee in The Whip and the Body. And this movie
is
fucking
nuts.
It is literally Christian Grey before Christian Grey. This guy, Christopher Lee, just shows up, grabs a whip, goes to the girl, you're dirty, you've always been dirty, you'll always be dirty. And then he starts whipping her, and she's into
it.
He freaking dies. And then that's not enough bondage for you. He comes back as a ghost and picks up the whip and says, hey, just because I'm dead doesn't mean you don't still want it. And he keeps going for it. And then it's shot like one of the most gorgeous movies you'll ever look at. So you're watching.
It's Bava, so it's
gorgeous.
Bava.
It looks like the, you know, drop of blood or something. It's shot beautifully. It has a couple shots that actually might be the best I've ever seen of a woman just sitting on the edge of bed looking up longingly. And it's just the colors are insane. But you're like, this is so fucking trashy and dirty. And Christopher Lee is someone. I'm definitely not – I'm always been Peter Cushing first, like just always.
Wow, okay.
Peter Cushing, I think, is just such a classy, interesting actor. Christopher Lee's always, to me, even though he's great presence, more with that one really strong note, whereas Cushing has kind of a range. And so this film is actually one of the best uses of him because he looks so intense all the time. And when he dies, when he's a ghost – and this is not really a spoiler because it's really about a ghost. It's a ghost story. I got the best description is it's basically Wuthering Heights with bondage because it is literally – the story of Wuthering Heights,
nice.
A love story with bondage. But it's, you know, what's the line? You haven't changed. I see you've always loved violence. It's like the first thing he says to this woman he hasn't seen in a while. It's a really crazy fucking movie. But, Shudder, I'm going to warn you, I have a feeling the last 30 minutes was out of sync. So I'm going to I'm gonna just send them an email just in case, because with dubbing, you think for a while you watch a dubbed film, oh, it's probably just the dubbing. And then at a certain point, I'm pretty sure it was fine for me because it's, you know, dubbed anyway. But
yeah,
really cool movie, though. Really, really beautiful. And so it's fun because Darren Scott was just like, I remember him just saying, this is really one of the great movies. So I, you know, it's fun to finally track that down. And it just totally turned out to be a Valentine's
Day. I need to see that. I've never seen that.
No, I've never seen it.
Shudder. Cool. I watched it in college when I really got into Bava. I binge watched a whole bunch of his films.
She was going to say Bondage.
Bondage. When I really got into Bava.
Mistress Becca.
When I really got it. Thanks.
You know what? One of these days, dude, we're going to have to intro the show by our, like,
Ryan Rotten.
Oh, that's funny.
But yeah, I watched a whole bunch of Bava back to back. And when you go from like his standard kind of killer movies, like his giallo-ish movies, into this, you're like, where the fuck did this come from?
Well, it looks, I mean, I mean, Black Sabbath. It looks like
his normal stuff, but man.
It looks like the post cycle of Corman's, but Corman's all into Freud, so they're kind of buttoned up and chased.
Yeah,
but this isn't. This isn't into Freud at all. This isn't a nope. You want it, and I'm going to give it to you.
I ended up writing a paper in college on the Corman post cycle, discussing how they didn't have to do anything outlandish because it was always internalized inside of Vincent Price. Yeah. He was so sensitive to everything around him—the colors, the smells—and so you didn't have to do anything crazy because
you don't
want
to see him naked.
Yeah. Well, with that.
Which, wow. No, I love how that was just met with silence.
That's called a breezy segue.
With that.
I was going to say, it reminded me of when I used to do news. I used to produce the 6 o'clock news up in Northern Michigan. And it would be like, so several children were killed and blah, 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 blah. And then it would be like, and now here's the weather.
Yeah.
And in cute puppy world.
Go for it, Becca.
Well, I wasn't going to lead with this one, but since we're on kinky fucking movies, I watched In the Folds of the Flesh from 1970. Have you guys seen this one?
Becca's staying on brand.
No, okay. I haven't. All three of you guys need to see this one immediately.
I assume we have to come to your house again and watch another movie.
I don't care where the hell you watch this. Just go watch it.
Strangely, Becca always requests that we come to her house for the weird stuff.
Yeah.
Well, that's because it's hard to find. This one, you can find a DVD. Okay. Actually, I think it's streaming on Fandor right now. I'm 90% sure it's on Fandor.
The fuck
right
is Fandor?
Fandor is actually, I've been kind of impressed
with
Fandor.
Amazon, Shudder, Netflix. She's like, Fandor. That's
today,
how, even my
today's Becca is brought to you by Fandor.
No, Elric's talked Fandor with me, I know.
I've never seen it, though.
No, it's another streaming service. It kind of focuses on older films, but it's got a lot of horror on it. I think it's $3.99 a month. I get it through Amazon. It's like right there. It's like an add-on with my Shudder.
So this sounds dirty. In the Folds of the Flesh.
Folds of the Flesh. So it is a giallo film from 1970, but it's a Spanish-Italian giallo film. Directed by, and I've never seen anything else from this guy, Sergio Bergonzelli.
Okay.
Yeah. And all I'm going to do here, just to tell you guys, I've never done this before, but I'm just going to read you the write-up
The
synopsis. It's only a couple lines long. An ultra-lurid, epic giallo packed with decapitations, pet vultures, creepy incest, groovy fashion, cyanide bath, swirly psychedelics, inexplicable plot twist, Nazi death camp flashbacks, and much more.
Wow. Who wrote that?
Written by Blumhouse intern.
No, that's the actual, like, when I watched it, that's the write-up that comes up for it on Amazon. But yeah, it is freaking batshit crazy. I had seen this a long time ago, like back when I first started with Fango. Somebody had recommended it to me. And I guess I did not pay as much attention this time because when I watched it this time, I was like, I remember none of this. And it's mad as cheese the entire time. So I highly recommend this.
Mad as what?
Cheese.
Oh, okay. Mad as cheese. What happens in it basically? Because that synopsis, I'm still confused.
Well, it's got inexplicable plot twists. So you think you're watching one movie, and then out of midway, you're like, oh my God, that's a completely different movie. The whole concept is that a group of siblings kind of kill somebody at the beginning, and one person sees them burying the body in the garden, and then he goes away to prison. And then a couple of years later, he comes back and tries to blackmail them. But the siblings are like, fucking nutty is crazy, and it goes from there. So yeah, it's a crazy movie. It's
Do you
all
know the killer, or is it a secret mystery?
Oh, no, you know the killer.
You know who the killer is.
Yeah, you know the killer's from the beginning. But part inside of that, there are twists as to who you think everybody is. So
typical giallo fashion.
Yeah, it's very typical giallo, but it's swinging 70s giallo with an amazing soundtrack and psychedelics, and it just goes everywhere. And it's so sleazy and so fetishy, and it's got weird incest and things like that. So you guys need to see this one. It's remarkable.
Do you even have to put weird before incest?
I don't think so.
incest inherently strange. And I apologize to any listeners who are incestual in their home lives.
Yeah, but somehow this one takes incest and makes it even more awkward, like to the point where you're just like, it's bizarre.
So more awkward than normal incest.
Normal incest. It goes more awkward.
So, I love it. Well, I'm sold.
In the Folds of the Flesh. Check it out.
Nice.
Ryan?
It took me a couple tries, but I finally got through.
What a review.
You're on a roll.
I know. Amityville 3D.
I totally understand.
No, you're right. Move on.
It took me and Elric a while to get through it in 3D.
Scream Factory put out the box set of 1, 2, and 3. And, you know, I usually reach for Amityville The Possession.
It's a cool movie.
Which is a great movie.
It's like five movies,
but
all
so good. It's so good. My favorite part in Amityville 2, The Possession, is when the the son and the father are arguing, and the son's got the shotgun. And he's pointing at his dad, and the mom is in the background. She's like, stop, stop. And then she starts walking towards the camera, and she splits between the father and son, and she grabs the shotgun, and then she holds it in her hands, and she's like, no. It's like,
and that's got the craziest incest
too?
Of all.
Hashtag creepy incest.
Oh, number two is crazy incest movie.
Like, with a cute girl from Better Off Dead.
Yes.
Dan Franklin.
Yeah. Yes.
All right, so three.
So Amityville 3D, if you guys don't know, is about a divorced dad who actually buys the Amityville house. Turns out he's introduced to it because he's a reporter and he was debunking a seance, blah, blah, blah. He moves in. He moves his daughter in. Daughter gets killed. Divorcee mom's like, but I just saw her in the house. Meanwhile, daughter's dead out on the front lawn. And then he pulls in a paranormal team to
Jennifer
investigate.
Jennifer Aniston comes over.
Jennifer Aniston.
No. Yeah. Oh, no.
Meg Ryan.
Oh,
who is
God.
Like, Meg I'm Ryan glows in that movie. Like, Meg compared Ryan. To everybody else, Meg Ryan's amazing. But it does have Aunt Becky from Full House.
Yes, yes, yes. Which is what Ciara said. She was like, oh, look, it's Full House.
Yeah.
But don't they spend more time at the fucking dad's office than in the fucking house?
It's a mix. It's a mix.
It drove me crazy.
It's like, it's funny because it's like, the movie doesn't serve to do anything other than just throw shit at you in 3D. Yeah. Like, whereas the first one, you're introduced to the Lutzes. Second one, DeFeo's, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then the third one, it's like, okay, you're moving into the house. What happens? I mean, it does dwell on the kind of nature of science versus supernatural a lot. Right. I mean, that is the thrust of the movie. But that's about it. There's not much else going
on. It's got that one good Chud monster movie. Monster moment.
Oh,
where
yeah,
big
yeah.
Monster
oh,
that's the only moment.
That's great.
Me and Rob were like, let's rewind that part.
Yeah, it's Robert Joy, who was in the Hills Have Eyes remake, and he's been in a lot of genre films. What's strange about this movie, though, is that Robert Joy gets pulled down by the weird Chud monster in the well, and half his face gets burned, and it's basically like a precursor to the Hills Have Eyes makeup that's done on him in that film because half of his
face
Land
of the Dead.
Yeah, and Land of the
like
Dead.
He's like half burned in Land
that's
of the Dead.
That's right,
well.
Yeah.
So either of these can be a prequel to either of those films.
Yeah, it's just him later on. But anyways, I dust it off every once in a while just to remind myself of what it is because every time I open up a drawer and I go, oh yeah, I got Amityville 3D, I forgot what that's about. Mm-hmm. And then I'll watch it and I go, oh yeah. What I didn't know is that Richard Fleischer directed it. He did 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Wow. Fleischer's a good director, yeah.
I recall when I first got my 3D TV and that came out, Elric came over and we struggled through it. But the only thing I'll say is that some of the 3D gags were really fun. Like, there's a moment in the early beginning where, like, she spits towards the camera and, like, that's funny. There's, like, a swordfish that's hanging straight.
Oh, the old swordfish.
Like the last 5 minutes in 3D is pretty cool. There's, like, a car crash. Remember that? Uh-huh. But that's all that excited us. We were watching the movie, like, falling asleep. And
neither of us could believe how many shots were at the office. We kept going, like,
when are we going to get to the house in this movie?
I remember thinking that this movie for me wasn't, like, I understood watching this why Meg Ryan became a star because she felt like she was in a different movie.
Yeah, but she's not in it much.
No, but it's the scenes that she was in, it was like, oh, she's I believe
much better
her. Much
the
better than the rest of them.
That's how I felt about Jennifer Aniston. It felt like she was in a different movie and turns out tonight
it she was.
Orange Salt Leprechaun was like, boy oh boy.
You really
she's
were
a
in a different movie.
Anyways, Amityville 3D, guys.
Very cool.
If you need to, round out that beloved trilogy.
Which one is the time travel one? Isn't there one with a clock.
Amityville, it's time.
Yeah, which one's
I get them mixed
four,
up because there's a 4, which is a Canadian movie, and I own that one. And then there's a 5, 6, and 7, which
there's
is
a Dollhouse one, too.
That's one of the 6 or 7.
That's the one I've seen.
Yeah, there's quite a lot. They're tough to get through.
Now, you don't have to tell me if it's off record, but isn't there a Blumhouse version? This is real, right?
Yeah.
There is a new one that exists.
Comes out in June.
Okay.
June.
And that's officially licensed Amityville film. It's not a weird knockoff.
Yeah, no.
All right.
Officially licensed.
There you go.
Frank Calhoun directed it.
Maniac director.
Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Yeah. Very cool.
I knew Jennifer was involved.
Bella Thorne.
Bella Thorne.
All right. Oh, yeah.
I set up all your Blumhouse bitches on the show. I'm the guy not being paid, but I'll set everybody up.
He paid you at this mug, so that's up. So here's a shocking one for you. And I watched it. I had to watch it twice in a row to do this. And I'm kind of breaking a scoop for you as well. Sort of. And I got permission from our sponsor, Scream Factory, that said I could talk about it all I like. So I revisited Psycho. And I mean 1998 Psycho.
Oh.
you know, the Gus Van Sant one.
Yes.
And here's the thing, because they are doing a Blu-ray release. They've already done all the sequels, 2, 3, and 4. And now I guess it was part of one of their licensing agreements. They picked up the remake and are giving it the high def treatment. And they had reached out to me and asked if I was willing to do an audio commentary, which took me a minute because I'm like, oh man, can I do that? So initially I tried to think of like, maybe I could take an analytical, you know, stab at this. And I asked Ryan, who mm-hmm. politely declined. Yeah. and I also asked Stephen Rebello, who wrote the book. Like, and I thought that might
be
one
of our best guests ever.
One of our best guests on Killer PV. He also politely declined. so basically, nobody wanted to do this thing with me.
Oh,
but
man.
Here's where it gets fun. I do remember that Amy Duddleston, who I met on Dexter, she was an editor for Dexter. She edited this movie. This was her first big theatrical movie that she got to edit. So I reached out to her and I was like, hey, would you be willing to watch this? She's like, you know what? Yes. Because she's like, you could ask me anything you want. She's like, I don't care what anyone says. It's the most fun I've ever had on a movie. I know people hate it, but I don't care. I get to work in a Gus Van Sant movie that, you know. So we did this commentary together.
Is it a Gus Van Sant movie?
Well, okay. So here's the thing. Here's my incentive to you guys.
When you're tracing someone else's movie, I don't know.
Obviously. But what's fun is because I rewatched the movie. I watched the original commentary that they did at the time, which is infuriating because Anne Hetch never saw Psycho and she keeps saying we did this so much better right here. And you're just like, oh, can I just – and Vince Vaughn is kind of new in the business still when they recorded it. So he's constantly doing that like pretentious actor thing like, oh, I think it's really interesting choices here, da-da-da-da. Anyways, so we got to watch this and we laughed a lot. And I mean, within 5 minutes, she's like – I asked her some question about something and she's like, yeah, this is where it all started to go wrong. And I'm like, oh, okay. So we're going to go into all that. And
because he starts to sign it. So he starts as a project of pure imitation as a – almost like an art thing, right? So it's like,
well,
I'm
going to
trace it, but then start signing it.
I was going to say, there's a great article that was in Fangoria at the time, mm-hmm. and I told Rob, I was like, the only thing interesting that I would have to say is just to quote the article. But I remember like they focused heavily on, you know, look at Broadway shows.
Right.
You know, you can keep doing Broadway shows over and over and over. The book is still the same, but the people, the faces are different. The choreography is different. And that's the approach Gus Van Sant wanted to do with it. And I was like, oh.
Yes.
Okay.
But
so.
Yeah. Yes.
While I was in grad school, this movie came out and I took a class on Gus Van Sant, and it was just the whole class was on Gus Van Sant and it was taught by this guy who was like an actual expert on Gus Van Sant. He focused his entire academic career just on Gus Van Sant movies. And his theory was that because Gus Van Sant had put clouds into Psycho, that made it his own.
Wrong. I'll explain it to you right now.
There's passing clouds, and that's like Gus Van Sant's big motif.
Obviously, I would like you to all listen to the commentary track or give you incentive to, but basically what it boils down to is this. I mean, Amy defends it because she's like, look, he was actually trying to remake Psycho or any movie shot for shot for years. Like, he was pitching it for years.
So he didn't really care what movie he was doing as long as he got to do it
I just heard he thought it would be interesting to do something shot for shot, but specifically Psycho was one of his favorites, so that's the one he really wanted for years and years and years. And it wasn't until Good Will Hunting made a ton of money that he went to Universal and they're like, fine. And he did it, and basically he got Universal Studios to pay $20 million for his experimental shot for shot project. What we discovered through the commentary track is that his question is, can it be done shot for shot like a play? The answer is no. Because when they got into the editing room, nothing worked properly. Because, you know, and Amy is very candid about all of it. She's like, I cut the shower scene shot for shot exactly like the original, and it sucked. Yeah. It just didn't work. And that trailer had come out with all the cool imagery. Yeah. And Gus is like, well, I don't know, just throw that shit from the trailer in there, I guess, because I like that trailer's pretty cool.
Clouds.
I was like, is this the first movie that was actually inspired by the trailer? They're like, yep.
Clouds, bondage. There's the bondage shot with the woman, and then a cow. They're the three things I remember when I think of that remake.
Yes, and it is totally shots. A Nine Inch Nails shot.
Yeah.
All that stuff. Yeah, it was just honestly, a movie is, you know, as you can tell from making a movie is one thing on the page. It's a different thing when you shoot it, and it's an even different thing when you go to edit it. And basically, they got to the editing room, and nothing was working properly. And
well,
it's like,
keeping their timing. I remember saying, there's a great making of, and I hope they got it.
Yeah, it is on there.
And it's a great making of. And he's timing scenes, and he's wanting, and you can't do that with new humans. Like, there are new humans,
and
movies
fact,
have changed.
Yeah, and then that's what she said. She's like,
yeah,
you know,
you
can't do it. Like, after a couple of takes, you have to be like, you have to let them do it how they want to. And also, editing, pacing has changed from 1960
to
1998.
Because we've already seen literally like hundreds of movies influenced by Psycho.
Yeah, exactly.
So you can't then go backwards. You know, the only casting that I think, because I really think the casting is
William
what,
H. Macy.
Yeah,
is the only
William
one.
H. Macy is a really fun. It's not better than, but it's almost as good.
Yeah,
as.
Yeah, it feels right.
The others are all pretty much wrong.
I'll say this: the best thing to come out of that was the poster art.
Yeah, poster's great.
Oh,
poster
yeah,
art is the best thing. I'm looking at it now on Box Office Mojo. I was like, because I wanted to see what the production budget was. $60 million. It grossed $37.1 million worldwide.
Yeah.
That was a $30 million experiment.
Oh, yeah. I think I've talked about it on an old show when it came up once before.
And it'll never happen again.
No.
Like, that's the one and only time in cinema history that something like that was attempted.
In my entire life of movie going, that was the worst reaction I've ever seen from an audience. It was a young audience. Everyone was about 16, 17. And I was sitting there as New York City whenever it came out. And I was kind of excited because I'm a Gus Van Sant. And the DP is Chris Doyle, who I think is probably he's like the Australian madman shoots of a Wong Kar-wai film. And I'm sitting there and there was such a lifeless feeling. And the saddest thing about it was I looked around going, oh, none of these kids have even seen the original. And this is how they're learning about the word Psycho in the movie Psycho. And it just felt so dour. People were walking out. No one was talking. It was just nothing. And it was probably one of the worst reactions. But, you know, who knows? Maybe I always wondered, though, if it would at some point have a camp intrinsic value like a Showgirls. I have no idea if it will.
I don't think so, because it doesn't have, like, Showgirls at least has a spark. Like, there's something there that keeps you watching.
It would have happened by now.
Yeah, probably.
Every time I watch it, it's just
movie. I mean, that was, like, what, 99? 98 it came out. I mean, like,
Vince Vaughn's particularly bad.
It doesn't work. It doesn't. And in fact, she revealed to me that, and again, I don't want to give everything away, but the first scene that Vince Vaughn did is Norman Bates' first scene, which is, you know, when he comes down and greets Marion, and apparently that was his first day shooting, which they talk about in the original commentary, but she's like, we had to completely reshoot that. It was so bad. Like,
well, and again,
nervous that he couldn't do it initially.
But the nerves, I think, would have helped. I mean, like, the problem that I had with Vince Vaughn was that he was too, and I mean, I don't think
he's coming off Swingers at that point.
Yeah.
Guys, he's coming off a Lost World.
He's an attractive guy. Yeah.
Jurassic Park, The Lost World was way before that.
But they also, the other sin, because he didn't just change shots. And I know why he did. He wanted to make it contemporary, right, and sexy or whatever. But it's like he actually has a masturbate, which is something you have to imply
in the original. Big debate, and we talk about
it. That's actually, when you actually show the person get off, you've now broken the cardinal rule of a slasher film, I think, by showing closure to it.
No, you're right.
I think the whole point is he couldn't get off, so he took a knife and stabbed the fucking people.
At least
that's
in
what
my
the myth of Psycho is. You know, so anyway, I find it an interesting experiment. But
right. Well, if you want all your all your questions answered, the editor will do it.
Okay.
She had no problem digging the dirt.
All right. Interesting.
What else did everybody see?
I saw a film that audience listeners have been telling me to watch for a while now. Has the aesthetic very much of The Witch. I kind of thought it was like The Witch and The Canal, a little bit of a mix. And you've seen it, Ryan. I mentioned the other day. It's the Finnish film Sauna.
Yep.
Oh, I love that movie.
Never saw it. This is kind of funny because I'd seen it on Amazon, the image. And it said two brothers and the word sauna. And I literally thought it was like an Eli Roth Hostel, like, party movie. And so when I started watching it and it was set in 1590, I was like, oh, I wonder when the backstory is going to end. And then
they're about cartography.
It was like an hour and a half of two brothers drawing up the landmass of Russia and Swedish border in 1590 while they're at war, which isn't all that entertaining. But the film does get really creepy, and it's really well made. It's a really nicely put together film. And I don't know much about, I mean, that's a period of history I didn't even know about. I think you'd probably have to be Swedish or from that part of the world to actually care what the border. But they're charting this border, these two brothers, and one of the brothers has been pushed to breaking point. He's killed 73 people, but he kind of keeps it to himself. He keeps saying this number, and they come across this weird little folk town, which isn't on the map, so shouldn't exist. And in the town, there's 74 people. And he starts thinking, oh, there's 74 people, and I've killed 73. And there's this one girl we left in this village. I wonder what the connection is. And there's this weird sauna, which is different than I think what we think of as a sauna.
Well, it's
in the middle
still,
of a swamp.
Yeah, it's in the middle of a swamp, but it's still kind of the same thing where it's meant to collect like the heat coming right. off of it. So it's still a sauna, but it's not like a like cool spa sauna.
No.
It's like a stone building in the middle of a swamp that collects heat.
Yeah, this isn't Spring Breakers.
Yeah.
Which I was going in for Spring Breakers, and as you know,
and,
the Finnish people are always so maudlin. Why do I got to bring us down? You know,
it's 1500s. You have this big giant stone building in the middle of a swamp, and it's pitch fucking black in there. So yeah,
no, and but the last act of it, when you start realizing it's like about these guys thinking they can get rid of their sins, but the sins have now manifested as these. The only thing I was thinking, can I actually last shift? That movie from a couple years
mm-hmm.
is the one that probably it reminds me of most in where it goes with the kind of ghost and the way they look with black. And there's some really cool monsters, so cool, really nice effects. But it's one of those movies that as soon as it ends, you go, oh, this guy's going to make something really interesting after this. I don't know if he's making an American film or what, but it was solid. So thank mm-hmm. you, whoever has been pestering me for the last couple years to watch it. That's how long it takes me.
I think I mentioned this to you because I discussed it on a Shockwave or a Killer POV episode a couple of years ago.
What, Becca?
Yeah,
what?
I know. What? I know. That buzzing in your ear that tells
you
to
watch. Well,
when
you recommend it takes even longer. It's like 2.5 years.
Oh,
but I'll get there.
Dude.
And sorry, I'm going to do this. I'm just going to do it. I'm going to do it once and I'll never do this again.
Uh-oh.
I'm
going
to plug the other podcast. I promise this will be the one and only time.
What's he talking about?
I started a show with Brian Sauer, Rupert Buckins.
Oh, yeah,
Speaks.
No, by all means. Come on.
It's called
it. You can pimp your show.
It's
called
your show.
It's the only time I'm going to do it. I swear. It's called Pure Cinema. I can't think where it came from, the idea of calling it that. It's on the Now Playing Network, which had a couple shows that I really liked, so I wrote to them and said, hey, you want another crazy film show? And the idea, somebody said, oh, don't leave Shockwaves. That's not the idea. If you hate, whenever I speak on Shockwaves, if you hate it.
Like the internet's like starting up a room. If I had read that, I'd be like, wait a minute, guys. I would have called Becca or Rob and be like, is Elric thinking of leaving?
Yeah, I know.
No, somebody did write the
best.
No, it was because I've just studied movies for too long to not want to talk about a whole bunch of different kinds of movies.
And outside of the horror genre, too.
Yeah, this will be, I think we'll probably stray more to cult and films like that, but it will be everything. Just because we both love Danny Perry's cult movies book, it's how we bonded. He was doing a documentary on that.
Oh, yeah.
Came to my house, we started talking about movies, and we're like, oh, you know what? That could be kind of a fun show. So check it out. If every time I talk on this show, you're like, oh, fuck, get rid of that guy. Don't listen to that show. I talk even more on that show. Bad news for you. But thanks for letting me play.
I was telling you beforehand, I think it's very good. I think it's a nice compliment to what we do here.
Yeah.
Although I do find it funny because you were like, I really need to talk about other movies. And then you guys keep like leaning back into horror.
And also, and then on this show, I've mentioned Wong Kar-wai three times.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Anyway, thanks. If you give it a listen, I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Did anyone else see anything else?
Yeah, I'll pull out one really quick. So I was sick this week. So I was like, I need something light and airy that's brightly colored that I can just stare at. So I watched The Apple.
Oh, cool. I've never seen it.
The 1980 musical. You and Brian need to discuss it.
I hear it's the craziest thing.
It's
not a genre movie, but okay.
No, it definitely, I'd actually say it does border. If we consider.
You want to come on my show?
Ryan's lost.
Come on, Becca.
I'm totally going to make this.
Because there's always one.
Because here's the thing.
All right, I'm bringing up Zahedi.
Do we consider.
Next week, I'm going to bring up Forces of Nature with Ben Affleck and Sandra Bullock.
No, guys, you guys discuss Phantom of the Paradise all the time as if it's a genre movie.
It's a genre movie.
Based on Phantom of the Opera.
This is based on the Adam and Eve story. The devil is a fucking character in it.
Oh, don't go biblical. Don't go biblical.
Seriously.
You're blowing out our microphones. Ernie's going crazy.
I've never seen The Apple. Tell me more.
Okay, so it's based on the Adam and Eve story. I will say it's a horror sense. If you consider Phantom of the Paradise to be a horror film, this falls into the exact same lines.
Right.
It's the Adam and Eve story. Two sweet kids move from Canada, I think. Come to the city to be music stars. They get kind of swept up in this kind of super mega thing that controls the entire world called BIM, Boogaloo International Music. And you discover really quickly that the guy is supposed to be the devil.
Mm.
And he tries to hire them on, but only the girl goes for it. The girl is played by Catherine Mary Stewart.
Oh.
It is her.
From Night of the Comet?
Yeah.
Now
I'm in. Like, she's the
lead.
I
love her. She's one of my favorites.
And so they get swept up in it. There's this whole, like, religious allegory of bite the apple, taste the apple. She does. The guy does not. And so then she gets swept up into this crazy world of sex and murder and pornography. That's him. See? It's the actual devil.
Okay.
It's the character.
I think she's got us, guys, on the devil.
Right.
There's an actual devil in the film. That's pretty cool.
So there's a song about having sex. And they actually, like, the choreography is people having sex.
Yeah.
The whole thing, there's a song about speed. like just taking speed, that has motorcycles in the choreography. So it's, if you consider Phantom of the Paradise to be a horror film and you like Phantom of the Paradise, this is so up your alley. It definitely boils down to kind of like disco is devil, hippie music is good, because the two people from Canada are total hippie folk music, and then they get swept up into the crazy world of disco, which is Satan. And it's got all these religious allegories and gods in there somewhere too. And yeah, it is absolutely crazy, but a lot of fun.
This one always ends up in most like good video stores where they have like all the crazy sections. This will always be the first one under the WTF every time. And so I've always picked up going, I got to watch that, because I don't like musicals much. I always avoid it. But one day I'm going to sit down and watch this.
You like Phantom. You would probably enjoy Phantom.
They do a great segment on it in Electric Boogaloo, that documentary.
Oh, that's right.
Because it is a Golden Globus movie. Got,
okay, that makes sense.
So there's a big chunk in that documentary about this.
And apparently Catherine Mary Stewart was like on her way to a dance class with a couple of her friends, and they were like, we're going to stop off and audition as extras for this movie. And she was like, meh, I'll tag along. And she's the lead in the movie. Like, she nailed it. And it's quite good in it. Like, she actually
she's
has a really good
scene. I really like her as an actress.
So, yeah, borderline horror, but definitely in the same vein of Phantom.
Yeah, so Turek's smirking.
I'm not smirking.
You
just
gave her the side
saying,
glance.
No.
Got anything else, Ryan?
Yeah, I caught up to there were two other movies that I watched. I finally saw, I haven't seen Wild at Heart in.
Oh, man.
Wait, we're going to consider that a horror
No. I was just bringing it up. There's,
hold it.
There's a couple gory deaths.
They
there's
ripped some teeth out, if I remember correctly.
No, someone's head gets blown off.
Spectacular fashion.
Willem Dafoe does blow.
Yeah, you're right.
But I saw Parents for the first time.
Oh. Remember,
and
I brought it up.
I
know you did. And Bill Neal, a friend of mine who cuts trailers and stuff, he had a group of people up at the house to show it, and I had never seen it. And I am so on the fence about it because there's no escalation to the movie. It is a singular idea, which is my parents might be cannibals.
Yep.
And then it rides on that little question every single scene, and then they kind of keep grinding on it and grinding on it and grinding on it. Until the big reveal happens at the very end, but there's no like upward motion of storytelling. It's just like a collection of scenes of this poor kid and his uncomfortable looks looking at Randy Quaid as his dad.
Or Randy Quaid is the escalation. Like if you have Quaid, you don't need any.
Yeah, well, I was going to say it's the performances. It's Randy Quaid. It's Mary Beth Hurt. It's Sandy Dennis. It's the kid. You know, it's all the performances. It's the production design. It's the cutesy little, you know, wink, wink things that occur, you know? Yeah. I mean, like, I think that's the charm of Parents. I mean,
I got to borrow this from you now that you both seen it.
I think you'll love it.
I cannot remember from being a kid.
But, I mean, what's crazy to me is, like, I want to know, like, I got to dig into some old Fangoria back issues, because I want to hear Bob Balaban talk about the film.
Right.
You know, Bob Balaban, yeah, I mean, great. Like, the first time I ever saw this guy, he's in Close Encounters. He's an actor in his own right, you know? And if you saw I'm the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House, he's in that as well, you know, and I just want to know what the impetus was to like make a movie like this, because in 1989, you know, when the film came out, that was like the year of the superhero, because Batman came out, you know, it was like edging up to all these big kind of summer movies. And I remember seeing Parents in the New York Times. New York Times used to do their Sunday edition used to do like a big movie section. And at the start of every year, it would be a time for studios to put out these giant full-page ads. And I would just sit there and pore over each ad looking at the new poster art. And I remember it got like a quarter page of Parents. And I was like, what the hell is Parents? You know, my parents were like, never going to see that. And I'm like, oh, okay. You don't even know what it's about. And you're like, about cannibals? That's inappropriate. You can't watch that.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, all right. So for me to see it, I think now, however many years, 30 years later, whatever, it was interesting. It was interesting. I know there were some folks who had seen it and were diehard fans, and we talked about it. I mean, I could see the appeal to it. I just still digesting it.
Yeah, know? There's imagery and shots and things in there that I just thought were spectacular and felt like they were part of like a – like I said, it's a David Lynch meets John Waters movie.
It totally is,
And actually, I think that's – because there was this trend in the early 80s, and David Lynch was a part of it, and it was very punk rock, where everything was harkening back to the 50s. And Parents does that. Like, the whole thing is shot in this very kind of 1950s aesthetic. Leave it to Beaverish. It's very kind of like Make Room for Daddy or all of those shows. My Three Sons. But yeah, and it just felt like it came a decade later than that kind of, because I mean, Lynch did it with Eraserhead.
Well, Lynch and John Waters.
Yeah. Everything was early 80s, and this is what, 89 or so, 90?
Yeah, so it feels like it's a couple years later than that trend actually existed.
Yeah, for sure. Lastly, I just want to give a shout out to former guest Mick Garris, who just launched his podcast, Postmortem, which was a video interview show that he did for Fearnet, and now it's up on YouTube and stuff like that, and on his interview, which I think is mickgarrisinterviews.com. But he just launched the show. First episode is Rob Zombie. I listened to it on the way here, and it is a great chat with Rob. I mean, Rob's always an interesting interview regardless, and I have mixed feelings about all his movies, but I always like hearing him talk. And, sometimes they hit some of the same beats. You know, Rob tells a lot of the same stories, but I found we started with Halloween Talk, we'll end with Halloween Talk, his very candid, now all these years later, his very candid comments about his Halloween movies were really fascinating, including the fact, I didn't know this, he said that Halloween 2 is the hardest movie he's ever made so far. And he was talking about some of the reasons, and one was he got hired back, he wrote a script, he's location scouting in Atlanta like 2 weeks before they're going to shoot. And he finds out accidentally, because somebody working on the crew let it slip, that secretly they hired somebody else to write another script for it, and they were going to try to force him to direct that script. So he quit. He's like, what? No, fuck that. I'm not doing that. I'm doing the script I wrote. And I never heard that before. And just a little thing. He said, the day before they started shooting it, they came to him and like, oh, so you need to cut out 2 weeks out of your schedule. You can't do, X amount of scenes or whatever. So it's just a really fascinating, Mixo is great at interviewing people. I always love listening to Rob, and he kicked off the show with a great episode, and it's very candid and revealing.
How
and
often is his show going to be?
I think it's every other week. And so this is the first one, and I know he's got, I just saw Stuart Gordon, Eli Roth, and Don Coscarelli are on cue for future episodes.
Nice.
So I think it's really cool. And I know a lot of people that listen to us love interview type shows. So definitely check it out.
I will also quickly say all of Unsolved Mysteries, like the original episodes, are now on Amazon Prime. I've been binge watching them. They're amazing.
Oh, and Riverdale?
And Riverdale.
I did get converted by Rob and a couple other people to watch it. I know I'm watching trash. I get it.
Yep.
But I want to keep watching
because
it's kind of sexy Archie trash. And I don't know what that is,
but
it pulls me in.
I love Veronica.
I'm actually going for Betty on this show, but on the comics, it was definitely Veronica. I don't know. It's an interesting show. It will depend if they know where they're going. It's one of those shows, like, if they don't know and they're just, like, going, okay, well, the first few we'll make intriguing and then we'll just hope for the best, that usually falls apart. Like, I remember The Following. That's how The Following felt to me.
Yeah.
It was like, these guys don't know what the end
of
this
is. You can only kill 50 people an episode for so long before
But if they have an actual real arc planned out and stuff, maybe it's going to go somewhere really interesting. Three episodes in. But I think it's worth a horror fans giving a shot to, just for fun.
Yeah. You can rent the episodes on Amazon because I'm doing it tonight. They're like $2 a piece.
Yeah.
Nice. There you go.
All right.
We'll break and then our guest. And we'll topic.
Topics.
Oh.
Alrighty, folks. This episode of Shockwaves is brought to you from Scream Factory, who are currently celebrating their fifth anniversary.
And they've released over 250 of some of the greatest horror, sci-fi, and cult films ever made, and you own probably half of them. You have to be close.
Who, me?
Yeah, you Rob, personally. I'd say Rob, you definitely. You have the most out of all of us.
I don't know about half, but I don't know, maybe like a fourth of those 250 titles, which, by the way, features some of the greats from Carpenter, Craven, Cronenberg, De Palma, Toby Hooper, finally getting the respect they deserve.
Dolph Lundgren.
Dolph Lundgren.
He's in there with one.
It's a great one.
I come in peace, yeah.
Many in the collector's edition line are packed with extras and feature newly commissioned art.
Yeah, and some of the new releases you can look forward to are Dead Time Stories, which is a pretty cool horror anthology, Firestarter, Stephen King's Firestarter, RoboCop 2, and I believe they're doing RoboCop 3, and this is exciting, Tales from the Hood.
I just mentioned Darren Scott a few minutes ago.
Darren had said for a long time, I don't know if there is an HD version of this
or if it
will ever come out.
And the DVD was in limited run, so it reached a point where that DVD was
out of
so expensive.
Yeah.
But amongst our friends, they couldn't find the print was the thing. And then Mike Williamson, our friend, had the only good print
in
the 16, and there was no neg. So I'll be curious to hear the story if they
I don't know where, but I know that they got an HD version of it.
Maybe Spike.
Tales from the Hood. So Scream Factory, we love them. You love them. Head over to www.screamfactorydvd.com to see all that they have to offer.
Yes. Yeah, maybe even listen to our, how many episodes? 3 episodes.
God, they've done, somebody I know did a supercut of all the times that Scream Factory was on our show.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I think it's on YouTube or something. I got to look it up.
That's awesome.
Kind of crazy.
Wow.
And right now, within 4 seconds, we're all going to recommend one for you to buy. The Battery.
Lake Placid.
Carrie.
Exorcist 3.
Boom. Okay.
Boom.
Oh, man. You got your money's worth.
There you go. For this episode, I kind of wanted to mix it up a little bit. We have a great guest joining us tonight. But I realized that right now, in terms of distribution, things are shifting. With generations, kind of glued to their phones, especially my kid. I'm realizing that people are taking in entertainment and taking in horror and consuming it in a different kind of way, either by their iPhone or their iPad or their laptop or their Apple TV or their whatever Amazon's calling their device or whatever Google's calling their device, you know, and it's things are constantly shifting. So I wanted to call this episode, How Do You Consume Horror? Also known as, kind of looking back on the VHS days as well, because we are all VHS kids. And there's this kind of weird resurrection occurring, and it's in a way that's not like records. It seems like there's a lot of pushback on the VHS kind of nostalgia. But for this episode, I kind of wanted to talk about how people are consuming their horror these days, how we're finding it, how we're discovering it. And for that conversation, I brought on Mr. Mark Ward of RLJ. He's the chief acquisitions officer over there. Mark and I go a ways back, and now we're kind of on the same side of the fence. We used to run into each other at festivals. We used to run into each other at festivals, but I was a journalist at the time, and now we're at all the same buyer screenings and festival screenings
trying
and stuff.
Trying to get into parties, and we're like, let's just go eat sushi.
He was at Sundance, and it was a great dinner.
That's so
Bushwick,
cool.
Yeah.
But, well, welcome, Mark. This is the first time I'm meeting you, too.
And, I know.
And it's funny, because we talked very briefly online, but for me, your name was the name that, there was a period when I was doing Icons of Fright, like when we were all doing the horror sites, basically. And a really exciting time was Anchor Bay at its height, when they had stopped doing all the older movies, re-releases of Dawn of the Dead and Evil Dead and all that stuff, and were starting to put out original movies. And your name kept coming up for all these movies that I bought. Hatchet, Behind the Mask, The Lost, Jack Brooks' Monster Slayer, like all these original titles. And there was a period there where anything Anchor Bay put out that I hadn't heard of was probably going to be an instant buy. Mm-hmm. Because I'm like, well, they're putting out quality stuff. That changed conveniently around the time you left.
This was also around Masters of Horror?
Yes.
Yeah, that was there for that. That was an interesting time.
It was the best.
That was a really interesting time, because it was like horror was slowly creeping back. We had gone through the J horror phase, and then it kind of went quiet for a little bit, and there was not much to get too excited about. 28 Days Later thing came out, and so on and so on. But it was around 2005 to like 2008.
Yep.
And there was just a glut of stuff and really exciting filmmakers, and Masters of Horror certainly spearheaded things.
That's also when we started seeing, we kind of transitioned from J-horror into more extreme stuff. That's when the torture porn boom happened. And so we saw this huge excess of it.
And that's why we bought that's why, Hatchet spoke to me, and even Behind the Mask, because it was such of that time, it was like everything was in your basement, everything was dark, and it was tough. And we saw like that throwback, and it was literally the poster, it was like, it's not a remake.
Right,
and it was, again, we talk about the VHS, that's what we grew up on. And it was the throwback to that. And even Behind the Mask was so different, but it was such a love letter to our heroes, the villains, in that world, that it just, it was funny too, because we, Anchor Bay at that time, was dabbling into it. Because I honestly, guys, I went to Walmart one day and I saw like the Man with No Name trilogy in a dump in for $10. And I'm like, fuck.
I even got it Blu-ray for like $6.
This is 03, kind of thing. And I'm like, guys, we're in trouble. you know, hurry, let's release Evil Dead for the 15th time this month. No, I'm just kidding.
But, it's going another
no,
year.
Army of Darkness, Elvira, House.
When movies were movies, as Steve Miner would said on the Soul Man, when he saw the New World pop up, he's like, ah, oh, when movies were movies.
Yeah.
You know, but it, we honestly, though, it was at the time going, we have this brand, you know, with – you know, like unlike not unlike Scream Factory has now. It's like we had quality, we had the the Dawn of the Dead 4-disc. Gosh, it cost more than some Blum House movies to make that disc. If anybody really knew how much that's we spent on that,
oh,
I would have got killed. I mean, I would have been gone.
Wow.
You know, it was gonna sell. Yeah. You know, and I went to the bosses and I said, if we don't start dabbling into new stuff, we're going to be a catalog company. We're going to get left behind. And to their credit, they're like, go for it. And that's when Behind the Mask, that's when Hatchet started. And then we started making a couple other movies. I think one of them was like All Souls Day. Like, I don't know if you remember.
Yeah,
and, you know, and it was, but it was like the,
but that was like All Souls Day was part of a larger package with a producer.
Correct.
Right. Yeah,
correct. Yeah, yeah. But we started
Jeremy Kasdan? Is that?
Yeah, it was Jeremy Kasdan.
Yeah. Wow.
And we started, like I said, dabbling in it, and then, like again, the big coup was Masters of Horror, and it was thank heavens it exists, but if we would have known more what we were doing, I think it could have been a lot bigger. I think we could have got more money from Showtime or things like that. But but to even for even that to exist was. For me, like I was in heaven, and it honestly, and it kind of exists. It kind of happened. Everybody was like, "Why did you release the first season as singles?" Well, one, it was a money thing. To we needed to recoup the production, but I wanted to make literally, honestly, what Anchor Bay does and Scream Factory does. I wanted the John Carpenter one to literally be in your encyclopedia of your DVDs or Blu-rays.
Right.
You go put it in there and it's Carpenter on Carpenter to go through all of his filmography. And then the masters on Carpenter. And then you go talk to Coscarelli and Mick and all these guys of talking about their hero, John, and then vice versa. So every time you get to put the Phantasms with the Kenny and Companies and everything together in Bubba Hoteps, but you had that Masters of Horror episode that had an hour episode with 2 hours of literally the Don Coscarelli encyclopedia chapter.
Right.
And that would always exist. And we got there a little bit, but it was, you know, but again, like anyway, it's timing.
There was
it's
a little
timing.
Yeah,
timing.
It was timing. You know? I remember you guys made it, tried to make a special. You know, had
the mausoleum box.
The mausoleum box, but there were also trading cards.
Yeah, we tried to do a swatch with the director's like illustrated faces. And I'll be honest, a couple of them are like, what is this? but honestly.
But Larry Cohen loved it.
Right. By season,
yes.
But it's funny to talk about the evolution or how you consume horror. Walmart, which at the time was the juggernaut of everywhere, and Best Buy, like they didn't do as well, and they came with, you got to make them look like a movie. You know,
I was going to ask you about that because I thought the first because they came out, what was it, like two or three at a time?
Yeah, I think it was like Incident and like Cigarette Burns, and then it was like two a month. I would say.
And they had the director really big on the front.
Yeah.
And then I remember by the time you got to the end of season one, the director was not really on the cover anymore.
Right. It was a key art that looked like a feature film.
It's the old adage like we talk about VHS and like artwork and like Mondo, how cool it is. But if we put up like a Mondo poster in Walmart, you know what they'd say? Oh, is this an old movie?
Yeah.
You know, and it's really sad. So we always say like, look, we will always have that exist for you at some point, you know, at some level, whether it's a theatrical poster or whatever. But again, tree falls in the forest, you know, I've had the fights all the time with the filmmakers. You've been, I think, at a bunch of these, you know, and I'm like, look, I'm like, I want everyone to see your movie to make, you know, I want your next movie to be, you know, you're going to be at the Blumhouse offices doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't trust me, like, I'm just, you know, we'll always have what you want. Like, a complete collaboration, always. And I've always, that's why I think I've gotten lucky of working, you know, constantly with, like, cool new directors and things like that is, look, I'm the same guy, you know. I don't know. I'm not the writer or director, you know. Yeah. But I'm, like what Jason always says, like, what I want to produce, well, I want to try to get your movies to as many people as possible.
Yeah,
and so that's, you know, I'm from a kid, you know, a VHS kid from Ohio that, you know, got lucky and through the side door of Anchor Bay in Michigan, in Troy, Michigan.
Well, let's go back. I mean, you know, I think to tackle a how do you consume horror today, it kind of goes back to those VHS days, those video store days, those mom and pop days before Blockbuster and, you know, before Family Video and stuff like that. You know, I mean, like, there's a whole generation. We talk about this on the podcast all the time, especially when we were talking about like Rings and stuff. And, you know, the characters like, oh, what's a VCR? you know, there was a time in which, you know, you walked into a store and you surveyed aisles upon aisles of just films on VHS. And it kills me now, which is so funny because I see these articles online where it's like, I sought out a Blockbuster, the last Blockbuster in America. And then they make like a 12-minute video of them walking in going, it smells like a video store.
And it's like, that's not a real video store.
Video Ventures.
Let's back it up.
That's the one that killed all the ones that we loved.
Yeah, exactly.
but no, I mean, like, I felt like we should open the canvas up to our own stories about, you know, like, what was that video store for you that you went to? That, you know, did you make a relationship with the clerk? You know, did you know those people? You know, what was that first?
Get horror.
What was that first title you picked up? You know, for me, it was like I had Mad Mike's. Mad Mike's was the place that was right next to the Stop and Shop in Connecticut, and I would ride my bike down there, and Mad Mike's got, you know, all that weird shit. That's where I got to see, you know, the old films of Sam Raimi, Rob Tappert, and Scott Spiegel.
Yeah.
Like, they had, like, just this weird, no key art, no nothing. It was just a VHS in a clear case with a post-it note that said, old Sam Raimi movies. And I was like, what is this? And it was right next to, David Cronenberg's, Crimes of the,
The Stereo Crimes or whatever?
Crimes of the Future? Crimes of the Future. And that was like sitting right next to it. No art, no nothing. It just said David Cronenberg, Crimes of the Future. And I was like, oh, okay, I'll take both of those, you know?
Wait, so they actually had like their home movies? Because
Sam Raimi did.
You would rent those.
They were just like,
that's
I think there was a short called The Helping Hand, and it was basically the hamburger helper hand running amok in some woman's kitchen, killing people.
Which basically became his skit in Evil Dead 2.
Exactly, yeah. No, that was fascinating.
Yeah, people always talk about VHS covers, but I think nostalgically, but they're forgetting the three-dimensional side of it, which was the VHS cover was the hook, but it was actually then looking at the back and seeing those three other photos, the write-up. There's something so tactile about it. It doesn't matter how great your key art on Netflix is, it is not the same.
It's
a totally different relationship.
Yeah. Sleepaway Camp is my favorite example of that. When you turn it over, it's the letter home, and then it trails in blood off. And we're like, this is going to be the greatest movie ever.
Yeah.
And it is. We remember.
I loved the big boxes, the big ones,
big
which were
shells.
Emulating. They were emulating porn boxes at the time. I think porn was the one who did that first. But we used to, our video store was called On Track Rental. And it was in it was supposed to be a house. It was like somebody's house, but this company had bought it. So it had all these different rooms in it. And it even had the beaded curtain room that you weren't supposed to go behind. But they had like the horror area. And of course, I made my way through all of it. But the majority of the ones in there, I remember being big box. And I remember there was this one called Body Shop, which I have since seen. And it's not so good. But the cover, I used to be so mesmerized by it. It was just like a decapitated head on the front. But
That's right.
Big box.
Yeah.
Body Shop.
That's right. It was a decapitated head, but it also had like an arm.
Yeah.
It's like a weird toy.
Yeah.
It looks like a weird toy. I've never seen the film though, so I remember the box.
I ended up buying it. It never made it past VHS. And finally, like a couple of years ago, I was like, I remember this cover. It was always so mesmerizing for me. I want to see it. And then I bought it and I was like, there's a reason it's never made it past.
Right? Like, I mean, and we also have all worked in video stores probably or had some sort of connection. So, I mean, I've done like two where they're part-time jobs and one where is my actual job, like the thing you lived off. And that's a different culture. That's when you get into that culture of clerks, right? And being at Amoeba all that time.
Tower Records.
Yeah, it's a different world because it's all about the relationships with the people. They come in, you talk to them. Either side of that, man, that's all my favorite memories are.
Years before, I think the goal of working at a video store is so you can get your own rack and put your picks on it.
You
could be the cool clerk that, you know,
picks. Now it's a podcast.
Now it's a podcast.
Pretty much.
But I do remember there was a period where I worked at Tower Records, and I think I was still in the video. I was in the video department, and then I worked in their art department.
Were you at Tower Records downtown?
No. Both locations on Long Island in New York.
Okay.
But I was in the Massapequa one. which our friends Dennis Woodmire and Kevin Kolsch used to shop at all the time, apparently. And they just let me have a rack at one point. And literally, I vaguely remember the VHS on there, but I know Dario Argento's Opera was definitely one. Nice.
Was
and
it
then,
the Eyes?
Yeah, yeah, with Eyes with the Needles.
Even back then.
So there was that one. What's it called? Chopper had just come out. So I was like, that's
the
a cool
little,
yeah. I was like, that's a cool obscure. Yeah, with Eric Bana. Yeah.
Uncle Chop Chop.
Which you just said, holding the gun.
You know, my one obscure Tarantino ripoff movie was like Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead and Suicide Club?
Suicide Kings.
Suicide Kings.
That's the
those
one.
Are
yeah.
not
oh,
obscure.
Yeah.
Those
yeah.
are
yeah. But the whole point of that story is, years before I met him, Mike C is the guy that I created Icons of Fright with. He remembers my rack. He's like, who is this Rob G guy that likes Dario Argento's Opera?
He remembers my rack.
Well, you know? Everybody remembers your rack.
Hey, now. It was a spectacular rack, let me tell you. but no, it's funny how that connects us. Mark, let's hear from you. What were your earliest kind of – did you always love horror?
Absolutely. Yeah. Fright Night was, you know, one of the, and Lost Boys, I thought, like, this is the cool, like, this is not only that, I mean, these are, I want to do this at some way. At an early age, I had an older, brothers and sisters, and gosh, by 10, I remember they were a lot older, like 10 years. So my brother and his friends would come over, and I remember vividly, they put on The Thing when I was like 10, and they left. No, I swear it was my dog and me, and I couldn't stop watching it, and I, you know, maybe that was the bug, I don't know. Like Raiders of the Lost Ark to me is horrific, and I remember going to see Popeye at the drive-in.
Oh God!
And that's all I want, and I'm like, this sucks, kind of, you know, like, and I fell asleep. My dad fell asleep, and then the next movie was Raiders of the Lost Ark. And my mom goes, you guys, wake up. And because what is happening? You know, and I remember we jumped over the seats and watched it. So, you know, like 12:30 at night and forever changed. I mean, I think it's a perfect movie.
Yeah.
So going back to VHS is we had a classic video, which I would say was more of the classier. I mean, you know, that's probably what Blockbuster would have bought. And then there was Home Video Ventures, which was they would have pieces and, you know, all that stuff like pretty prominently out. And I remember obviously the Bad Taste and then the Frankenhookers, like just of being the one a date, you know, things like that. But I'll never forget this kid named JC Neese, you know, JC, wherever you're at, you know, this is what a weird story is. He came over to my friend Derek's house with Reanimator. And I don't know, we're in seventh, eighth grade. And I never had seen anything like this before. They got passed around at that point. Like we were all like going to school, like you got to see this. Like there's a decapitated head and you know, like what is, you know, for a seventh grade boy, eighth grade boy, we're like, what is happening? So ironically, to be able to release that movie, 25 years later and know Brian and Stewart. I mean, it's just like a weird, you know, life, and that we all live, you know, and, but the one, I don't know if I've told this story before, but we had a rule at slumber parties, the moms would not let us rent an R-rated movie. So being the Eddie Haskell I was, like I would circumvent it, go and look for unrated. And we rented Blood Diner one night. And so this is probably like 89 or 88, you know, 12, 13 years old. And we were like, what is this movie? And now, ironically, which, you know, what Arrow's putting out a $40 Blu-ray, you know, which is
lovely.
It's weird. I bet it is. Strong. But I have not seen it since, you know. Yeah.
And Jackie was on our show a few weeks ago talking
you know,
about it.
So, but again, it was like the Argentos that, I mean, what is this stuff?
Yeah.
Like seeing that Inferno scene. I mean, not Inferno. Yeah, Inferno scene with the underwater.
Especially when you're an 80s American horror consumer, the first Argento you see is so fucking weird. Like, I remember not getting Suspiria. I didn't get it.
I didn't know. I didn't either. I didn't know. And remember, they're probably 4x3.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, like, so it wasn't even... But it just was like, what is this movie?
It was vivid. Well,
what is the guy from Fraternity Vacation doing in this movie?
Well, I mean, it's a deep contrast between Reanimator and like, you know, Blood Diner, and then contrasting it with Inferno. It's like there's beauty and then there's schlock.
Right? But I think you love it all, right? And then you're looking for the next what the fuck moment, right? Uh-huh. Because I remember I just had a memory. Yeah. You know, I'd seen the Universal Classic stuff. My cousins got me into Nightmare on Elm Street and some of the franchise stuff. But I distinctly remember having a sleepover. There was one of the kids was having a big sleepover party, and it was like, we're going to rent like a bunch of movies. And the first one was the unrated version of Bad Taste, which none of us ever heard of, never seen. We just liked that there was a middle finger on the front cover. Yep. We're like, that looks badass. Let's rent that. And I mean, within the first few minutes, we were like laughing our asses off, and like he's like pretending to shotgun somebody, and they think they're getting shot. That's happening. And our little minds were blown. Yeah. And I think what happens is there comes a point when you see that and you're like, what's the next craziest thing I could find that I can't imagine? And,
well, how do you go deeper down the shelf?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, for me, it was always, you know, I mean, before Mad Mike's, there was this other store that we could go to. My folks would always like kind of veer off towards comedy and drama. Meanwhile, I would steer the other way behind the curtain and sneak back there. But it was always, what's further down the shelf that you can grab? It's like, okay, I did my From Beyond or Reanimator or whatever. Now what's the next thing? Oh, there's the body parts, you know? There's whatever.
Body shop.
Body shop, yeah. Or body parts.
Jeff A.
Yeah, Jeff A.
Well, also the trailers, upcoming attractions, played a really important role at a certain point because we still didn't have the internet, right? So you'd go home, you'd watch that movie, and whatever was before and after the feature, you would remember those films to look for next time.
Oh, yeah.
Was there anything that's like you were too scared to rent?
There was a couple of things. I remember The Hills Have Eyes. It was because of Michael Berryman on the cover. Yep. I'd seen him.
Me too.
In Weird Science, and the cover of The Hills Had Eyes freaked me out so bad. It was years before I rented
Redemption
that one.
Films. All the ones with the Redemption. I was telling them, like, the little icon itself.
The little black and white, whatever that was.
And I saw one with the skull, and I was like, because I knew it was probably erotic stuff mixed with horror, and I was like,
they were all just
that.
Gene Roland.
Yeah, and I still haven't really gotten over it.
it wasn't so much the scare. It wasn't so much the fear of watching something, because I just wanted to keep pushing the boundaries like Frank and Hellraiser. Mm-hmm. It was like, I just want to keep going and going. It was the fear of what would happen if I got caught. Uh-huh. That was because I would would rent something, but what if mom and dad caught me and I was like watching something that was just too much?
I never
That's interesting.
Because
your dad supported. Sexual stuff is the weirdest
and,
stuff.
And in my house, horror films were used as a treat. Like, oh, you got an A on the spelling test. Go pick a movie. Yeah. You can pick anything you want. And
she's
so
like,
they
Hellbound.
Were, Hellbound, mom. No, and they were a reward for me. And I mean, my parents kind of figured early on that, you know, if it works and it's getting her straight A's, we'll just keep doing it.
A reward or something to take away. Because I remember when I fucked up my math test for one summer, and my dad's like, we were going to go see Total Recall.
Oh,
we are not going to see Total Recall this weekend. And I was like, this is fucked up. He's like, well, get your fucking A's up, man. And I was like, ugh.
Wow.
But it was always something that was a bait, you know?
Yeah,
like, you want to go to the video store? Behave.
Well, and look how social it was. It was like you're remembering the films you saw with a group of friends at their house. I had the exact same experience as you, but it was Reanimated too, and I've told this to them before. I'd never seen one, and no one told us it was part two. Somebody puts it in the player, and we're all watching it, and it opens with a fucking discombobulated head saying, you bastard. You did. And I'll never fucking forget it because we didn't know what the fuck the movie was. And so I think years, I was like, what was that movie we saw with the head guy? And it was just totally bizarre, but it's burnt, you know, into your mind.
You mentioned the social thing, and I said this on Heather Buckley's podcast last week, and I suddenly felt so old, but I don't know how kids date now, because when I was in high school,
what you did.
Netflix and chill.
You would pick up your date, and you would then go to the video store, and then you would spend an hour perusing the shelves together, talking about movies. Okay, maybe this was just in my movie geek world, but you would spend an hour talking about movies, and that was like your small talk and how you got to know each other, and then you would have to come to a consensus, or if you couldn't come to a consensus, you never went out on a date again, and even that with friends. And so like I have memories of like first dates with guys in high school where I'm like, oh yeah, we watched The Langoliers. And like I can remember going to Blockbuster with these guys renting movies. And that was like, that's how we met and talked. So I don't know how you do that now.
I rented Dracula Dead and Loving It, thinking it was a surefire, like, oh, she doesn't like horror movies, but kind of caters to my taste, but she maybe she'll laugh.
That'd be funny.
Nope,
didn't. Yeah, that was the end of that.
That was the end.
Well, Mark, tell us a little bit about how I want to do part topic, but also part interview, because I want to know a little bit about, you know, some of the stuff. I know it's a broad question talking about how you got to Anchor Bay, but how do you make that transition as a fan that consumes horror to then being involved with it? Because you said you wanted to be involved in some capacity.
Absolutely.
And so how did you get to acquisition?
You said you worked in a video store too?
Nope. I'll never – it was – Best Buy, Christmas season, gosh, what did it be, 1998? And I don't know if you guys remember it. It was a two-disc Halloween set, VHS, and orange thing. And I'm like, wait, a VHS has extra features on it with deleted scenes? Holy shit. Like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. And I flipped it over, and it said, you know, Anchor Bay, Troy, Michigan.
With a weird little sailboat.
With a sailboat. And ironically enough, I went to Ohio University, and they had this program really fast. They had this program that it was – a management associate trainee program. It was essentially a grad school that you got paid for a year. But it was Handelman. It was called Handelman. That's who owned Anchor Bay. And they were a music rack jobber. So back at the time, unlike studios shipping directly to, you know, Walmart and all that stuff, that's why like Sony and Universal and Fox like takes everybody and puts them in there. They had middlemen for music, which was did Kmart, Walmart, and Meijer, I think. And anyway, so they had this little – we weren't even in the building. They wouldn't even let us in the building. They're like, these fucking guys, you know, the Halloween shit, you know, but when I got there. But anyway, they were literally Jay Douglas and Bill Lustig, who I will say deserves those two guys. They, you know, long story, I'll get to them. So when I got there, I was like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. And this girl, Julie, who was in my wedding, you know, she actually worked at Anchor Bay until they ended. You know, a couple months ago. So she was there, head of marketing, great, great mind, great person. She was like, that's Handelman. I'm like, I'm going to work at Anchor Bay. And by hook or by crook, it's the only place I interviewed was for this Handelman job. Like, and I was a marketing major. And sure enough, I got it. So the first day I got to Handelman, I drove over to Anchor Bay and this Jay Douglas, I was, you know, I was joking, like, I Bud Foxed him. 52, I called that dude. I came over there every day. And he was like, here's some Army of Darkness. Here's this. He was like, just get out of here, kid. You know, kind of thing. And I bothered them for a year. And they created this acquisitions coordinator job and literally got thrown into the fire. Like, and you're going to L.A. next month. And I'm like, I've never been to L.A. And long, you know, I think one of the first meetings we had was with John Carpenter. We had Musso and Franks. And Jay wanted to release his – what was his band's name that he did in the Blue Trouble in China? Like, he actually did
The Coupe de Villes.
The Coupe de Villes. Yeah. He wanted to do like a, there's like recordings and videos of that. And they John's like, good. I don't know. He's like, bro, I don't know, man. Yeah. Like, anyway, but I'm like, I just met my hero. You know, this is so cool.
Was this still a VHS or DVD?
It was the train was leaving for VHS and the DVD was coming in.
Okay.
We would release them both like a thing at the same time. So one of the first things I got to work on, you know, and Bill was the pioneer. Bill Lustig, you know, a filmmaker, was the guy who honestly brought all the Italian horror to the U.S. And everybody says, like, you know, the joke about Anchor Bay back, and they're like, oh, another Evil Dead release. And I always said, there would be no Suspiria. I mean, there would be now. There would be no Suspiria at that time. If we couldn't do that, because they were like, what is this? You know, this, nobody knows what this is. And we're like, they do and they care. And if we do it, and you're going to spend $65,000 on top of it to do extra features.
And yeah.
You know, and it worked, you know, and so that sailboat mattered, you know, and it really did. And it was a great, you know, it was like almost famous for me. You know, it was like, I was literally that VHS kid working with my heroes, like Don Coscarelli, doing, he's now become, you know, a friend, you know, an actual friend. You know, he sent, like, when one of my kids was born, they sent this beautiful coat and everything. And it was this is super weird, you know? But that was the best run of, like, the Dawn of the Dead, Hills of Eyes, sort of the corn of doing those extra features and things like that. Now that, you know, and Felsher, you know, Michael Felsher still does that now. Michael worked with me, you know, forever, you know, and I'm like, look, you got to go do something, you know, you got to go just do this, you know, and he still is. Mm-hmm. And it kind of laid that groundwork of now that Scream Factories and Arrows did it, but, and, you know, I'll never forget the culmination of it was winning that Dawn of the Dead Saturn Award, and I got to go get presented here because Romero was doing, was it Land was first?
Land was the.
And so he couldn't be there. So they're like, all right, you do it. I'm like, okay. And Simon Pegg, who it's not, he was just after Sean. So it wasn't Simon Pegg yet.
Yeah.
Like hands me the award and I get to like speak in front of the Saturn Awards. I'm like, this is, you know, but that was, after that, I was like, where can you can't go back.
Yeah.
You know, like it's over. And you're like, would you, you know, like, why don't you release, the Hellraisers or whatever. I'm like, I did, you know, 15 years ago, you know? And so I would rather go literally like my goal is to, I was joking to say is to be the minor leagues. So Jason can go maybe take some of these filmmakers on his next movie. And, you know, that's what segued me to, I want to be, you know, like I said, we had Bad Taste. We had Peter Jackson's first movie. We had Sam Raimi's like first real movie, Evil Dead. Why not do this for the Adam Greens and the Joe Lynch's and, you know, the Joe Bagos's, you know, and things like the Craig Zollers with Bone Tomahawk. Oh, you know, now look what was going on with him. Like he's, you know, he's shooting through the thing. So I always want to be that, you know, get your feet wet.
Yeah.
Roll up your sleeves, you know. Sometimes like, you know, sometimes everybody still wants to have the big deal and go. And I go, look, you're going to learn everything. You're going to roll up your sleeves. You have to roll up your sleeves. There's not a whole lot of marketing. And that's how we consume horror now is how do we get it out there?
Right.
Yeah.
Walmart, who knows? You know, Best Buy, who knows? Like, how do you get it out there that's not packaged goods of like the old Anchor Bay days? And now and Scream Factory has their niche, you know, already covered of how they have their fan base.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Is Walmart still one of the biggest sales? Sorry.
For hard goods, it is.
Okay, because like back my Fango years, I worked with the acquisition stuff at Fango for like 5 years ago, I guess was the last time we did it. And then it was like still like you're nothing without Walmart.
For hard goods, that's absolutely.
And I think still for physical, okay. You have to get into Walmart. Before we jump into
the tangent.
I was just curious for everybody because we always talk about VHS in our early days of that, but does everybody remember the change from VHS to DVD, and did you embrace that format? Because you had mentioned Bill Lustig. I remember getting the clamshell anchor bays of every Argento movie.
Absolutely.
And it was a big deal.
And also the Hammer stuff, too.
Yeah, we have the Hammer stuff.
I have the Devil Rides Out, the Reptiles.
I think they should remake Devil's Rides Out. I think it's great.
Yeah, that's the best one.
Me too. That's a good point. And this is what I think, too, like the overall of how we consume horror is different than maybe our kids now. I think because we are the VHS generation is now we can buy pieces and it has an hour and a half of extra features on it. That's us.
It comes with a puzzle.
This is our baseball cards for my older brothers or whatever. This was it. DVD / Blu-ray. That was literally our love, like that was our collector. That to me, like on top of now, kids maybe you know what they collect is games. I mean, I'm not saying they keep the games, but yeah, I don't know. There's just so much different for them. But DVDs, especially with extras, I think took us children of VHS who watched, and I think it has a little to do with the 70s and 80s being such a weird 80s movies. You know, I love 80s movies; they're my favorite. You know, I think they're hilarious, and I'll watch Fraternity Vacation tomorrow. You know, like I think they're just something. I watch The Apple now. I'm like, ooh, I'm gonna go watch that. Katamari Stewart. Are you kidding? You know, I love her.
Well, it's funny because we're at that weird period where we grew up. We're of that age group where we grew up with all these movies we loved. Yeah. And then we got to see DVDs where we got an explanation for how they made, like all these weird things.
Film school.
How did that happen? How did they get made?
Don't forget Laserdiscs.
Yeah.
It was a rich man's game, but it was something that, I mean, like it was prevalent in my household just because my dad was a maniac about his movie consuming and then it kind of passed. It was like sins of the father passed to the son because I was like, oh, man, I'm really pushing carts at Stop and Shop today because I really need to put in some overtime. I need that Japanese Army of Darkness with the alternate ending I've never seen before. I really need it. $65.
Wow.
You know, but
that's like a Vestron title.
Yeah. that's
what like the Jay Douglases of the world, they said, you know, like I want to create that, but, you know, and it wasn't. I mean, it was Warner as well, but like it was –
But it was. I was going to say, if it wasn't for Laserdisc, like I probably wouldn't pursue. I wouldn't have pursued going to film school right away because I was like thinking about special effects. I wanted to do special effects, and I sat down and the Criterion did this absolutely beautiful Bram Stoker's Dracula that was literally film school. It was how do you make this movie?
And Francis Ford Coppola.
That's the one where they showed the rink that they set up the.
They ported it back.
They did all this stuff. There was the Laserdisc itself had like revolutionary software where you were able to cut a scene yourself. Where you were able to pick. Okay. You would watch takes of Winona. It was a simple like two camera setup. reaction shot, reaction shot. But you would be able to get, okay, I want Gary Oldman's reaction. I want Winona Ryder's reaction. I want this piece of dialogue. And I was there like 3 a.m. My parents are sleeping and I'm like learning how to edit.
I remember that one vividly because I remember that when I mentioned that they showed you how they set up the track during the carriage ride, they showed that it was on an actual track. And I remember them discussing how they crossed the 180 line.
Yeah.
And I learned what the 180 line was from that bonus feature.
That's right.
It was film school. It was. It really was.
And like I said, I think that it was, and I hope somehow, some way, like our kids learn that.
Yeah.
You know, I still worry about my kids. Like, he's like, what do you mean it's not on Netflix? You know, like it's like, oh,
we talk about that a lot. We say, when is Netflix going to start putting the extra features of these things on, you know, and start thinking, caring about that kind of stuff? It could happen.
We get in. I mean, like, that's what I think the evolution
should be.
I think Filmstruck will do that.
You know, and things like, I think Shudder is a great opportunity to do stuff like that. And I mean, they have a lot of our movies, and I'm like, well, we own, you know, like the Hellraiser Anchor Bay stuff, you know, and that's now no longer, it's almost, it's just sitting on a shelf.
I know.
Like what, you know, I'm not saying it's monetarily, am I going to buy that extra? Like I just watched the Fright Night doc.
Yeah. Mm.
I thought it was great. You know, it's an exhaustive, you know, 4-hour documentary, but to me, that's what I want from our favorite movies. And I think, where do I find that now when Hellraiser isn't really available unless you order it off of Amazon?
Yeah. What was everybody's first DVD?
The first one I saw was Texas Chainsaw because it's the first commentary I ever saw. And it was such a good commentary. I don't know when it was, but I didn't have a DVD player for a long time. I was staying with VHS, and then I was at a friend's house, and they're like, oh, I have a DVD. And I was like, oh, I haven't watched one yet. And he put on Texas Chainsaw, and I just remember looking, couldn't believe how good it looked, for one. And then we were listening to the audio commentary, and I just remember going, oh, that was like film school, when they were talking about how they actually shot the shot that follows her low angle from the swing in. And you're like, oh, shit, okay, that makes sense. It was great. I don't remember when the change happened. I mean, I remember History of Violence was one of the last ones, wasn't it?
Last VHS, yeah.
Is that the last VHS?
Yeah.
Produced. Okay, here's a weird story. Porn. Always to the porn. No, I was working at a video store. This is like my freshman year of college, so it would have been like 97. I was working at a video store, and they got porn on DVD before movies on DVD. Yeah. And I remember that was like this crazy thing because in it, you could switch angles mid-act. You just push this button, and you could like turn the whole camera around and switch angles. And I remember sitting—
That's how you learn the 180 degree.
I remember sitting in the break room, and none of us were there for the porn. We were just mesmerized that you could switch angles mid-scene. I have no recollection.
I'm still kind of blown away. I want to see that.
I can't even remember.
That's crazy.
It was nutty. And I remember that like that was the very first DVD that we had gotten into the shop. And I have no clue what porn it was, but I remember that feature and just being like, this is amazing.
I mean, like, why are you really thinking about, like, the angles while you're
watching? Yeah, I know. I really need a shot. I really would like to see this from maybe 45 degrees to the left. I would be much better than this,
I think Blade 2 was my first. Blade. The original Blade.
And I remember those New Line, like, all the special
Platinum series.
You got all excited. I remember distinctly, I was working at Tower Records. I was still on the floor. And what I remember was we had a DVD player that we sold at the store, and everyone was buying with their discount, but it was still too expensive. Like I couldn't afford it. So I just would jealously watch everybody buy the DVD player. But I bought DVDs first. I was like, you know what? I like this double disc Army of Darkness. It's all these features. It's got the director's cut. I can't believe it. So I bought that. I bought Suspiria. I think I bought Suicide Kings.
Were those the limited ones?
Yeah, that's the thing.
So you had to buy them.
I didn't have the format yet, but they were limited.
Yeah, I agree.
So I was like, well, I have to own these before I can never get them again.
Is that the box of Suspiria, the one that comes with all the cards?
It's a three disc.
I've got that one with all the cards. And you know,
so I bought those before
the soundtrack.
I bought those even before I had a player. And then finally, I think I had about 10 or 15 titles. And I'm like, this is it. I have a little extra money. I'm buying the player. And everybody used to make fun of me at Tower. And I was like, you know what? All you guys are buying your player and you're going to go home and watch the same freaking movie. I already have a library.
Yes, right.
Going home, I got Suspiria. I got freaking Army of Dark. Now I got it all covered. So I remember
that distinction.
You haven't
changed at all.
No, I haven't.
You're exactly the same dude, but with a bigger collection.
Yeah, with much bigger.
I remember going one day. I'm like, this is it. Today's the day. So we go, we buy I think it was like a five, I don't know if it was in the five disc. No, maybe not. But I had to, I thought I had to buy a tuner and like speakers with, that's how stupid I was. And so I get it. I like so I buy this, the tuner, the DVD player, these like tweeter speakers. And because I thought I had to have them. And I bought the Nightmare on Elm Street box set.
Oh, yeah.
Like, and that, I think essential. The Matrix. Because yeah, I was like, yeah. Oh, you got to see the Matrix. So I get home. And, you know, it's like, gosh, like it's like my first page, you know, it's like first paycheck in the real world. This is what I'm buying. I get home, I look around, I'm like, and components, like I had the wrong TV. I was like, so I was like, I would not be. So I go back to Best Buy and I buy like this 27-inch Sony TV.
Whoa.
Can't get in the car.
Oh,
so,
nice.
So I had to call my friend Jamie in the truck. By the time I set it all up, I put in like the Nightmare on Elm Street bonus features. Done. Yeah,
that was
out.
Look, that was a great box.
That was the best.
I mean, God, the menu system was like revolutionary.
You had, talk about the porn angles. Like you had to go navigate through a haunted house to kind
to
of
figure
thing.
Out. Nightmare. Pre- yeah.
Oh, cool.
You know what I miss that I don't know if they even do this with Blu-rays, but there I used to have a pretty big DVD library. There used to be websites. Well, now it's Blu-ray, but I'm saying with the DVD format, there used to be multiple sites devoted solely to Easter eggs on DVDs.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
So literally, you would look something up, and it's like, if you go right, left on the menu screen, you'll get a bonus feature. Yeah, I'm like, what?
Which is
and
always
it's like,
pissed
it's
me
something
off
I owned.
Yeah.
And then you pull off the shelf, and you're like, I can't believe that was on there this whole time, and I never found it. So I don't know if they still do that, but there used to be so many of them. There was the Nine Inch Nails live concert whatever.
Yep.
And you could literally unlock like three more songs if you went to
so
a certain
annoying.
Menu.
It was annoying.
That was the anxiety I felt with the Nightmare on Elm Street box set because
did I miss anything?
You would miss stuff. You know, you'd be like going down the hallway and it'd be like
that Fat Boys video.
I'd
be like, honey, this is not on here. And she's like, keep looking. And I'd be spending all night just like going down
it's
these creepy hallways and just pressing different angles. I mean, it was anxiety.
You'd have to wait.
I
want
to do this now. This
I got to show you one, but you know, Behind the Mask. Did everyone find the Easter egg on there? Do you know? Yeah, you must know.
No, what's funny because they put it on there, and I was like, you guys, like,
why did you just include it?
Just include it. Yeah, well, I don't even remember.
Basically,
what it was.
On one of the title screens, you can click right, and it'll light up something in the corner, and it's like,
yes,
how did Leslie fake his death? And it's a quick deleted scene where when she's, spoiler alert, when she's crushing his head, it pans down to his hands, and he literally pulls out like a walnut and puts it in a cruncher to make the cracking sound. And it's like, that's how he faked his death. But you have to look for it. It's on the DVD somewhere.
That's fine.
But speaking of that, you know, like to get into like, I wonder if that was like, especially that movie. Now it's been 10 years. I see it's going to play at South
By. It's going to play at South
By. Like it was I want to say before its time in terms of how distribution was, you know, because back then there was no VOD, you know, we had to do like a limited roadshow or whatnot. And I honestly, I've said this before, like that movie, you know, like I stay up at night because I wanted that to be, I'm not saying Saw, but I thought that was going to take, you know, that and like The Hatch was going to take Anchor Bay to maybe be like the Lionsgate or like on its heels, you know, but.
Well,
let
me ask you about that because
I
remember I was still living in New York at the time, and I knew both movies before they came out, but they got very limited theatrical.
Yeah.
Me and my friends went at least two or three times into the city to see Hatchet because we're like, this movie's cool and it's so much fun with an audience. Behind the Mask played on Long Island, and I brought a group of friends the opening weekend, and we were like, maybe two other people were there along with us.
I think we did a Fangoria screening in the city of Rise of the Leslie
Absolutely.
Vern. I was there.
So what was the difficulty in getting an audience for those movies at that time?
I think it was absolutely the money. I mean, I think it was
advertising.
Yeah,
getting people to know it exists.
I think you found out quick. Like, look, if you want to get pregnant, you go all in. Like Cabin Fever, I think it was around the same time, and then it was House of a Thousand Corpses. Mm-hmm. I'm sure Peter Block would tell you, but like they had to spend
a lot.
Minimum $10 million, maybe, to get their release at minimum, and you know we're working with $1.5 million to you know, and then you found out shit. This is a lot. This is a risk. You know, to put that all to go chips all in, especially with people like going, well, there's no digital yet, so it's literally DVD,
right?
You know, and TV was at the time was like, yeah, Showtime will take it for $25,000. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, unless it hit a box office milestone, and so it was. How do you make now? You can now. There's premium VOD. There's digital, there's SVOD, there's TV. You know, there's a couple more, you know, I call it buckets that you can try to hit. But I don't know. You know, like I said, to this day, I'm like, man, what it could have been? You know, if they would have said, here's $5 million, Mark, fuck it. You know, go for it.
But for like Hatchet and Behind the Mask, for example, and correct me if I'm wrong, but at that period, didn't it make the film more valuable to say that it played U.S. theatrical?
Absolutely.
Okay, so how did that work? Like if Hatchet played in a few screens in New York City, can you sell it?
Yeah, you could ship another 50,000 to 100,000 to Walmart.
But doesn't that still the case? I mean, like people still four wall.
Yes, but that's absolutely. So now it's more to get The Policeman on iTunes and Comcast and DirecTV and Dish and, you know, Time Warner. You have to, because now everybody can say, well, I went theatrical. Like, no, you have to go theatrical. And you have to literally check off the theaters have to be LA, New York, 10 top, you know, top of the top 25 markets. And you got to, you know, and that's, it's still four-walling, let's be honest, you know, like, but it's, you know, you have to try, you know, in a way. And that's the beauty. Like, it's weird because I think people are catching on, like, while in theaters, like, okay, you know, I can still, you know, rent. I mean, like, I would rather spend that money on two theaters and really try to build up and platform that out, you know, and go for it. You know, like Bone Tomahawk is the biggest success I've ever had on a movie. I wonder, could we have done The Witch? Could we have been It Follows? You know, like, could we have hit a number? Yeah, I don't know. But how much would we have to spend to hit that number?
Exactly.
And then how much we, you know, because I can tell you the filmmakers, you know, who are doing, you know, Brawl, I think, is his next one. Mm-hmm. And then he's doing a Mel Gibson, Vince Vaughn cop movie next. Like, he's going, you know, he's
that's
going
awesome.
Up. You know, he's doing a Ridley Scott. You know, Ridley Scott's doing his book. I mean, his career has taken off. So would the success – I mean, you know what I mean? If they would have done, say, $2 million at the box office, would have that different been – right. It's the biggest premium VOD movie, you know – maybe, you know, in a long time. Like, it's a benchmark for a lot of people now to say, I'm looking for my next Bone Tomahawk.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, and that's something to be said, always to educate the filmmakers. Like, look, it's okay that it's not going on 500 screens, like Blumhouse Tilt. You know, it's okay. We can still get your movie out there. Look, Will Smith's doing a directed Netflix movie.
Yeah.
Brad Pitt directed Netflix movie. And I would say I would rather maybe still do the 10 markets, you know, and still do the premium VOD and then eventually get to Netflix, you know.
Yeah. Or Netflix buys their own little movie theater and they limited run. They play it there for, you know, a week, go straight on.
Not possible. Ryan shaking his head.
I just don't think they're interested.
No, they aren't. They aren't interested.
They don't have to. Sure.
The theatrical model means nothing to them.
Yeah.
There's no interest.
And like I said, and then there's, you know, like I said, Shudder, you know, is another, like it's, you're sitting there buying exclusives and I think that's cool. You know, I think they have.
But their parent company's AMC, right?
Right.
So the money, there is still pool of money.
Right.
They're not like an indie.
Right. And it's funny, but I think Netflix too, you know, I think it's driven by television series still, you know, and I think it'll get there. I think, you know, look, I think Hush to me, the reason that it worked as much as we heard is because of you guys, is because of the community talking about it.
Right.
And so if you don't, again, it always is going
to
go back.
We wouldn't get that. We wouldn't be privy to the numbers that it did. However, I would scour social media to see how many people were talking about it.
Right.
And if I saw a lot of people talking about it, then
Ulrich made the greatest point about Hush.
The festival. Yeah.
Which literally we heard about it at a festival. And then 2 weeks later, it was on Netflix.
Yeah. You talk about Toronto?
Yeah, and
here's the thing. Hush was at South By, and then we did.
Right, but I saw it at Toronto, and it just said distributor screen.
Oh, yes.
But so it wasn't
we did do that.
Yes, so.
But in general, I mean, I think that's something they should do more of. I think it's a waste of opportunity to actually get buzz. Like even Oz Perkins is I'm the Pretty Thing in the Wall. Like play that at a couple festivals first, get people going crazy for it.
And then, I loved February or whatever it's called now.
Yeah.
Black Coat's Black
Coat's Daughter. Think about it. That movie's still not out.
Yeah.
And his second movie that he shot is already been out.
Yeah.
I mean, why, you know, I think, who knows? Like February.
Yeah, I'm very curious how it will
affect. Is people going to talk about it?
Because it's a long time. Like a year of waiting is one thing, but 2 years of waiting,
but
it'll be curious
to
see.
But it's a very, we're talking about a very specific bubble, though.
Right, but let me ask, as Ryan, as you know, an exec that we're going to, like, hey, we have Oz's next movie, you're going to be like, well, I don't know how it did. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Yeah, like, it's interesting, that model of, like, I could say, Bone Tomahawk did X amount of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
You know, and all these buckets. But look, I mean, if Netflix is going to buy a movie, you know, you got to, you know, I get it. You know, that's the thing. Like, that's why it's kind of still a little bit the Wild West right now. It's like we're all figuring it out of how, you know, my thing is I always tell, especially the horror filmmakers, I'm like, you are the biggest marketer. I know that sounds like I'm taking a back seat. I'm not saying that. I'm saying my marketing dollars are limited.
Yes.
You know, and how do we get that out there together? Mm-hmm. And I need Rob and Elric and Becca and Ryan talking about it. Mm. I need all these people.
The filmmaker needs to do the work.
They
need, you know, it, and that's
because it will pay off.
I told a friend filmmaker who was going to have something on debut on DVD, not DVD, VOD. And I said, what have you done so far? Nothing. Well, are you going to, when's it come out? A week from now, what are you going to do about that? Like, the outlet's not going to do anything about it.
Yeah.
You have to do something.
You really
about
do.
It. You have to do the outreach. Have they spoken to you about PR? No, not really. You have to do the work. And if I don't see you doing the work, I'm going to yell at you.
Yeah. Without it, it's a box with hopefully a cool cover and a 2-minute trailer.
Yeah. Deborah Logan. Yeah. I think Deborah Logan's still
Deborah
the
Logan
best
was
example.
The biggest, because, yeah, biggest word of mouth.
Because
thing.
Our listeners told us about it. We didn't know about it. We watched it. We plugged the shit out of it.
Oh, God,
and then suddenly fucking everyone was talking about it. Yeah. I mean, not just because of us, but I'm sure other shows
that
like
that happened
us
simultaneously.
And, yeah, and seeing with the battery that.
But Adam's pretty good at getting word out there, too. Yeah. Like, he did, you know, and look what, again, it pays off. And,
oh, yeah.
And I would have loved to take that movie. I think Adam's great. And basically said, hey, remember me when you're doing, you know, Blumhouse movie
and
7,
City
8, 9, you know? Like, said, yeah. Like, look, I, you know, I always jokingly said, like, what did you want to be when you grew up? Like, you want to be Carpenter? I'm like, no, man, I want to be Mike DeLuca. I want to be Michael DeLuca.
Yeah.
He wrote A Nightmare on Elm Street, and he did a perfect movie in Boogie Nights. And he's doing Nightmare on Elm Street movies, and John Carpenter, he wrote In the Mouth of Madness.
He did, yeah.
That's the guy I want
to
be.
He's like my dream guest, actually.
Yeah. Right.
Me too. I will come. And I'm like, you're going to hire me.
That's a good show. Both of them?
Like, Mike DeLuca, I know you're out there.
Yeah,
call us.
I was reading an article on Deadline with him today, because he's involved in the Oscars.
Exactly.
And I was reading that.
Yeah, he's doing the Oscars.
He's doing the Oscars. And I was like sitting there going, man, because I was like you. I mean, like, I was reading about this guy, Mike DeLuca, who was writing A Nightmare on Elm Street. He was writing A Nightmare in the Mouth of Madness. He wanted to be a producer. He was getting, like,
yes,
there was, like, scandalous stories surrounding
just
him.
Google people.
Yeah. Well, it was in Premiere Magazine. We had Premiere, and I was like, Premiere Magazine. I was like,
that's where I read
who's
it,
this too. Mike DeLuca
he's
guy?
A stud.
Partying hard, man.
He's going to be trending after, like, this episode.
No,
Mike DeLuca.
He was definitely a part of the kind of career trajectory. And then to see where he's doing now, where he's like talking about doing the Oscars and like being a major producer.
Look, it's not unlike Jason, you know, with Whiplash and things like that. Like, it's, you know, like, you can still do both, you know. And that's what I think, you know, I got to the point, you know, like with, like I said, the Dawn of the Dead and all that. I'm like, I want to, you know, I don't care about winning Oscars, to be honest with you. Like, I would rather be remembered to do, saying, oh, my, that's the guy that helped do whatever, the, you know.
Yeah.
You know, movie, I don't even know what movie it is yet. But you know what I mean? Like, that's the goal. And then have that, I mean, and that, hopefully that filmmaker goes on and says, to, and you're like, look, work with him, you know, because he's going to treat you the right way.
Yeah.
And that's,
man, I feel that. I was going to say, I wanted to ask you guys, when was that time that you guys kind of offloaded the VHS tapes?
Oh, man.
When was the time that you completely let go?
Well, I don't think I ever, well, not until recently, which I'll save until we get further along down chronologically, but I converted everything. So, like, as DVD came along, I converted all my VHS tapes over to DVD, but then somewhere in my collector mentality, I realized that a lot of things were getting trapped on VHS. And then I kind of reverted back to the VHS love a lot. And that even amplified as video stores were going out of business.
Yeah. I remember I just brought mine into work. Like, one of those big
Tupperware
bins, and I was just like, have at it.
Just take
what you want. Because, I mean, like, it was all stuff that I had to move.
Well, I had to move an apartment.
Like,
I moved an apartment,
moving
after college. And I was like,
it was college. It was after university.
I'm like, where am I
going to
– by the way, My mother still has all those Disney clamshells in her basement.
Oh, cool.
Oh, wow. And I'm like, those actually might be worth something.
By the way, and I was like, just throw them out, Mom. And then I saw that somebody put, I'm sure it was, you know, some stupid, like, clickbait website, like, these Lion's King, is it worth $1,000?
I think we wrote that article, guys.
He looked right at Becca when he said that.
I know, right? But yeah. You read the article.
No, I did. And I literally copied and pasted it to my mom. And she's like, well, why would I do that? I'm like, what else are you going to do with them? You know, so.
Yeah, that was the one format that, you know what it is? Because like, at least with DVDs, there are enough stores and places, at least here in New York and L.A., where you can sell them back and get some sort of credit or some bucks. Yeah. I don't remember VHS ever having a healthy sellback portion.
I don't either.
No. It just jumped rights to DVD, so you had to just get rid of them. You either donated them or whatever.
The nostalgia thing you're talking about, like VHS and records having a similar nostalgia, but the difference is the return of the record is return of superior sound.
Oh, absolutely.
And the nostalgia for VHS is just misplaced.
Well, I mean,
what it is, it's the Arrow box sets. That's actually, you get the best pristine version of it, but you get the feeling
of
the VHS.
It's the emotional connectivity to the tangibility of the VHS that – and that nostalgia that's overriding the quality.
You don't want to watch a VHS tape for the most. No. I mean, I know we have some people who that's what they're into, but overall, you don't want to watch that. But there are those movies that still have not made it onto any other format, your Black Rooms and stuff that I still will put, I'll still hold on to that VHS tape and nothing else.
Those are the only ones I still have. I've purged everything unless it is still trapped on VHS tape.
I kept the Anchor Bay. There was the snow globe of Halloween.
Yeah, cool. I have that too.
And by the way, I might have threw away the VHS.
I
have the snow globe.
But there was definitely a point where when video stores started closing down where I felt this, like, I have to save them thing. Yep. And I don't think I've told this story on the show before, actually. But the video store that I used to go to in Washington, D.C. all the time, this place called Video Vault, at the time I'd been working for Fangoria for a while, and they knew that. And the day that they decided that they were going to close down and they started selling off everything, they called me in New York, and we're like, we're closing down, everything's going 50% tonight, you can come buy whatever you want. And Dave and I drove from New York City to Washington, D.C. on a Thursday evening, like a six-hour drive. Went there, I didn't have any money because I was working at Fangoria and living in New York City. I put it was close to like $700 in VHS tapes on my credit card. Put them all into the trunk and drove back to New York City that night. And I made sure to get the things that, like, even by that time I was like a refined collector, I'll call it, where I was looking for the things that, you know, you couldn't just buy on DVD. Yeah. So I ended up with like Poor White Trash 1 and 2 in big box clamshell because those weren't available anywhere. Severn released them recently. But
of course they did.
Previously, they were not available.
Wait,
so.
Not Poor White Trash 2. Morawski has the rights to that.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, he does. Yeah, I don't know if he's ever releasing it. You could have bought Fangoria for that price. Come on.
Right. Ooh. $700.
Too soon.
$700.
Damn.
Yeah.
It was funny. I worked at the Blockbuster on 32nd and 3rd in Manhattan.
That was closed by the time I got there.
That was closed by the time you got there. And I didn't have a rack. I just had the aisle, the horror aisle, because they made me they were training me to be a buyer. Hmm. And then they were like, Ryan, take a crack. Here's a catalog. And I was like, okay, what do I want to see? And I just went down a list. And we had 2 boxes of horror titles just come in.
That's awesome.
And I just bolstered the entire horror section. So when Halloween rolled around, we had the best selection in town.
Yeah.
And as soon as when I quit and I took like, you know, a real office job, I went back and I was like, yo, where are all these titles? And they're like, we sold them. We had like after you left, we went back and looked at who rented them, and you were the only person. So we put them in the bargain bin and we sold them all off. And I was like, you couldn't even fucking tell me, huh?
Wow.
I was so bummed. So bummed.
Previously viewed videos, man.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Because they used to be $99 to the retailer.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's it, because they didn't want you to buy it. They wanted to, you know, sell to them so they would rent it out. And I remember there was one, it might have been like Nightmare 5, where I'm like, all right, can I get $90 to own this movie?
Wow.
It's like, you know,
you really want that Nightmare 5.
That dream child.
Listen, 13-year-old thinking, it was a mistake.
I just remember taping them all, like on the, doing a like SP, and get 3 movies on there, you know, like
SLP.
Fright Night.
Yep.
Nightmare 3, and, you know, like, oh, I've like, never touched these. You know,
well,
like,
I would also label them. I would actually try to like emulate the label and like draw. Right. Like, I was like, Killer Clowns from Outer Space. Let me try to get that font.
Right.
Oh, we had sweet font.
We had a little book. That's so we'd have, you know, three movies per tape.
Yep.
And my dad numbered them. And then we'd had the book that's like, number one is Godfather, Fright Night, and whatever else. So yeah,
my parents were the worst bootleggers, and they didn't even realize what they were doing. They just kind of, you know, oh, well, if you put a piece of tape over this, you can copy any movie you want. And they did. Okay. And so we had massive like bookcases full of videotapes, and my parents, they're still at
McKendry
my parents'
bootleggers.
House. Yeah. And it wasn't like, but it didn't even dawn on them not to do this.
Nice. That's what they're telling you, their child, that they were that ignorant, that they knew how to put tape on a VHS tape. I don't think so, Beck.
It's weird. I've been like kind of bringing it up to today. You know, it's like I can't. It's funny. Do you guys watch stuff on your iPhone or iPad at all?
I watch David Lynch.
See, I do.
See, so do I. I mean, like if I'm at the gym or I'm on the treadmill
or
something.
No, that's different. Yes.
If there's something I'll download it onto
the TV. Yeah, TV or stuff, but not a movie.
Not a phone.
Not even a TV show.
Not even a show, a movie you've already seen like millions of times.
I'll watch like a trailer.
I haven't, but I might do that.
I keep it to short form. Trailers or if there's like a 5 or 10 minute video on YouTube about something.
Yeah, no, exactly.
But I would never watch an actual movie or a TV show on
My iPad all the time because I'll be typing on my computer and I set up my iPad right next to me.
I will do that.
And that's how I watch a lot of movies.
Yeah,
If I'm on the like Sundance, like I'll have my iPad. You know, but now I bring my Apple TV and then I watch on the big screen.
There is that. Yeah, no, that's so.
But like I always bring my iPad for the plane ride. I'll download a movie off like Prime Now, or you can download.
Netflix lets you download.
The thing that bums me out is like go ahead.
Oh no, I was gonna say with like screener copies, which is how like in the horror world, that's how I get a lot of stuff, as I'm sure you guys do too. I used to, on my desk at Fango, I had an inbox that I just had screener copies written on, and I would have stacks of just DVDs and paper envelopes on that. And now I have a folder on my inbox in my email that says screener copies, and it's where I put all the links I need
to
watch.
Send me a Vimeo.
I
can't watch it that way. We were talking about it before we started the show. And it's like, I don't want to watch a link to a movie on my computer. Like,
no. But now with Apple TV, there's a Vimeo. I have a Vimeo app. That's why I always want Vimeo, because then I'm like, I have to AirPlay it. And I try. Right. But I always, it's everything's through my Apple TV. So I'll go, let's say you guys, I don't know, send me movie X. I'll hit the watch later. I'll go to my Apple TV and it'll be on there, and I'll watch it in, you know, 1080p, you know.
I have a FireWire into my television, so all I do
it's
is
an
just
app on
plug
my Apple TV. Anybody can.
TV.
Just,
no, you know, I've always just tried to figure out how to exactly get the link to play the what I want on my Apple TV.
Right,
but it's
impossible.
the watch later feature.
I got an indie TV that RLJ uses to send out stuff, because it's actually really good for piracy and things like that. It's not, it's like, I would say the safest one, and we'll send it out. But for me, I'm like, I have to AirPlay it on my phone. Do I have enough juice? I'm like, I'm charging my phone at the same time.
Yeah. Is there going to be glitch? That's the thing, it's technology itself. I mean, like all the convenience of it still makes it
difficult. Well, that's why I think the video, you know, to reiterate, I think the video store's closed too early. I really do. I just think, what happens when the cloud goes away? You know, it's like where, you know, now I've now bought Nightmare on Elm Street, the series on DVD, Blu-ray. Oh, and they had the Apple $50 Halloween sale. Fuck it. You know, so now it's everywhere. You know, like
copy.
But, you know, like I want it somewhere. No matter where I am, I can have it, you know, and that's and that's one of the things about like Blu-ray is like, oh, they're right there. But it's right there on, you know. The thing, you know?
Yeah, I think I've been spoiled more so than these guys, because you guys still use your Blu-ray players.
Yeah, I've noticed that. Yeah, that's
cool. I wish.
I've just never had a flawless streaming experience, no matter what. Like, even like Amazon, it'll look fine, but then the subtitles will be a little off because my internet connection isn't as strong. Or same thing with Netflix, and it's like you put in a Blu-ray, no problem. It's going to look exactly the same every time and be great, and you can do subtitles or commentary or features. So
I've been breaking down, I got to say, lately, and it's unconscious, and I think it's like Wall-E. You know, when everyone gets real fat and they've got the little things and they're all going. I feel like
we're
that
all
at
in
times.
The Matrix.
I'll get something I really want to see on disc from Netflix, and it'll sit there for fucking 3 months, but I'll watch a bunch of shit I don't want to see streaming on Netflix. And it's just, I got rid of
my Netflix disc a couple of months ago.
I did right when they split it.
Yeah, me too.
I was like, you know what? I'm done. You
but know. Now the idea of having to order a DVD seems completely foreign to me. Yeah. Like a couple, we were going to go see Lamora is playing at CineFamily in a couple of weeks. And I was like, let's go see it. And then I realized I can't go that night.
Then
so
you
I was
reneged.
Like, I reneged because I'm shooting where that night. Go. But I was like,
what am I going to do Friday night?
Yeah, right. But,
I'm sorry,
but
guys.
Don't you like that's the laziness of that I've experienced of with like said the DVD or if I wear a red box, I'm like I have to watch it that night or it's an extra dollar. But when it comes on, say Amazon, for example, Green Room, yeah. I would have wanted to watch that movie forever, right? And by the way, it's my favorite movie of the year.
Mine you know, too. Like, my so, number one film of the year.
Me too, by far. And yeah. But when it came on Amazon, I'm like, oh, I'm not really feeling like watching it right now.
Dude, we have like the exact tired. Same experience. It's like, been sitting you know, in my been like,
and then my kid will come in, and my kids will come in, so and funny. They're like, what is this? And I'm like, can't watch it right now. So I don't want to start it and stop it.
Yeah.
3 weeks it took me to watch my favorite movie of the year because it was there.
Yeah, well, yeah.
The temptation, I mean, like, yes.
And we have so much to watch. I mean, there's
so
much.
Unlimited, well, that's the thing. There's so much, and I have like a giant collection of stuff that I love. And I've been – my – since I started at Blumhouse, my purchasing habits have increased in terms of buying like the Blu-rays. You know, like I got popcorn on the way. Like the Diabolic DVD just said, your popcorn's on the way. I'm like, yeah.
How much was that set? That was a fortune.
Yeah, it was like $50. Yeah.
Is that the Synapse one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is when it comes down to the weekend and I've got the girlfriend nearby and we're like, what do we want to watch? I'm like, let's just roll through all of them. Let's see what's on Amazon. Let's see what's on HBO. Let's see what's on Hulu.
But then
let's
I'm
see what's
asleep on by the time I get through.
No. But the desire is what have they put up that I haven't seen in ages that just had in the vaults and they just went, here you go.
I go to Instant Watcher every morning. There's Netflix and Amazon. Yeah.
Shudder, and I just got Fandor has become like my two go-to ones.
Yeah, Shudder for sure. I've been catching up on a lot of stuff.
Fandor.
Brought to you by Fandor.
Fuck is Fandor.
You guys need to check it out. It's actually got some really good, it's older films, but it's good stuff.
She's also the CEO of a company called Fandor.
I'm telling you guys, I give, Elric, you're going to like it. You are. No, you're going to like it.
It's funny though that it's,
well, the funny thing is like the kind of need, the desire to go through HBO and Shudder and all these like things is tantamount to going into the video store and just walking up and down the aisle and going, well, maybe this. Oh, but then there's this. And then hours later, you finally picked a movie and you go home and you go to sleep.
Right.
I'm telling you, there's also the difference, and I maintain this all the way, is that there's no skin in the game, man. Netflix, even though you're paying for it, it feels fucking free.
Exactly.
You forget it. But when you went into that fucking video store, you had to lay down money to take that thing home, and you wanted to watch it to get your fucking money. Yeah. And you'd watch it again right before it was due.
And it's tiny amounts, because we canceled our cable a year ago because I was like, what the fuck is this $80 charge a month? No. But yet, I mean, I now subscribe to Fandor, Shudder, Amazon Prime, Hulu.
Yeah, they're cheap. A lot of them are cheap.
Yeah, but cheap together, I'm sure I'm probably paying $80.
Maybe.
HBO Go.
Stars.
I mean, we have all of these different apps. I also have Sirius, so I'm sure that,
same
you
here.
Know.
Same
you
know,
here. You curate exactly to your taste, though.
Yeah.
That's the difference
but
between
But to your point, I forget that I have what I have sometimes. I'm like,
I know. And well, that's when I started cutting. I was like, oh, I got Stars only because I wanted to watch
Ashes of
Evil Dead. Yeah. I was like, there were so many good horror titles on it. I don't need that
that's
extra
all right.
temptation.
We'll get back to it.
Well, what's coming up for you next? What do you guys got?
So we bought Bushwick, out of not necessarily horror, but it's so
it's
well, it's fun.
Genre fans.
I think it's going to do very well for us. We just announced Pilgrimage again, not really horror, but it's, Tom Holland, John Bernthal, Richard Armitage. It's from the, from the producers of The Raid.
Yeah.
And then we got a couple others that we're going to announce, fairly soon.
Cool.
But no, it's, like I said, we've had a good year. I try to get like one Toronto Midnight a year, Mind's Eye was the last one, Bone Tomahawk, even though that was in Toronto, it was a fantastic fest. I got to say, Dallas Sonia, I think, is an up and coming producer. He's got this really great, we talk about like what's could come from, horror. You guys should really check out the Cinestate. And I'm just saying, I'm plugging a friend.
Mm-hmm.
But he's got this, not unlike what Jason did with the Blumhouse book, but he's like looking for like the next like Stephen King and they're going to do audiobooks. But what's cool about it, they'll go and get like actors to do it. Like he does.
What's this called?
It's called Cinestate. I think for horror, especially horror writers and, essentially, potentially directors, there's something to be said there that you can actually go and he maybe puts out an audiobook or an audio, and then with the goal to make the movie. Right. Again, it's like it's the graphic novel thing. Yeah. You know, like remember when everybody was like, oh, let's just make a graphic novel just so we can sell it. Yep. You know? Yeah. But this actually could be, you know, something that drives as a guy, like I, for example, I peruse Amazon Kindle for like the next horror. I've read so many, like, is it Adam Cesari books? Like just of like, because I'm looking for what could be the next cool horror movie, you know, but it's hard for me to, not to disparage Amazon Kindle, but like, it's hard to find that right stuff, you know? And I think the future, especially with evolution, is concentrated, you know, places. I think it's honestly re-educating our kids, you know, too, you know, like I just worry about the days of like us, like every kid discovers the Doors, every kid discovers Pink Floyd. Is my 10-year-old kid going to do that? Mm. Because there's so many YouTube stars that they care about more, you know, and it's, you know, are they going to discover Halloween? Are they going to know the original, hopefully the one next year, you know, I'll take my, five-year-old to it. I'm just kidding. but honestly, my 8-year-old dressed up as Freddy Krueger. He's never seen a Freddy Krueger movie, but like for Halloween, like he thought it was hilarious. It's more concentrated. I think there's always going to be clearly the theatrical route, which, you know, Jason does very, very well.
Right.
I wish we could do that, you know, and maybe someday we did, but it's a lot. It's, you know, it's very risky, you know, and is the reward there, especially when the ancillary isn't what it used to be. Back when Peter, you know, and those guys did Saw, it was 1-to-1, you know, it was like $1 million would sell $1 million, you know, in dollars in DVD. Not the case anymore. Yeah. So it's
how much was that Lou Reed song for your next for the trailer? Does anyone know? Was it like a couple million or something?
They aired it. They showed it once at Sundance,
and it's not even in the movie.
Right.
It's not. And they have a great song in the movie. You could have used on trailer, but you know that's your marketing play. You know,
yeah.
It looked like because he had never licensed that ever. Lou Reed was like against licensing that song.
He hated horror,
right?
So that was the big obstacle.
Really?
There. So I heard.
Hates horror.
Well, I mean, you know, that's what the filmmaker said about.
I think about he did a Poe album. Use it.
But
cool.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully cool. this conversation was enlightening for us.
Yeah, no, thank you guys.
I thought you would be the best person to bring in a kind of trip down memory lane.
Like I always, you know,
to talk about the ever changing distribution model and why things happen the way they do. I think kind of popping the hood and getting in there, you know, is good every once in a while.
Yeah, so. I just like I said, I think people just keep supporting, you know, like horror.
Keep supporting what you like.
Yep, and look, thank God for like, you know, there's the IFC Midnights out there. There's Shudders. There's, you know, Blumhouse Tilt.
Yeah,
I mean it's cool. You know, like I always, you know, it was like, what kind of movie like would you want? I'm like, you know, I steal a line from Lars, you know, and some kind of, I'm like, just don't be stock. but sadly sometimes, you know, like those, you know, but I'm just like, look, if you have something that you have a model, go for it. You know,
have you done the lady getting dragged down the tunnel yet?
Absentia.
And if so, how many of them?
Likely ways to die. Yeah.
I'm sure we did.
God damn it, all right. Mark.
You're
God
guilty. Then you're guilty. But here's the good.
Yeah. I try to be as cool as possible. I know.
Right. All right, Mark, thank you for coming on.
Thank you, guys.
Nice listeners, don't forget to visit, and I think we should plug this more. Don't forget, we're on social media.
Yeah, man.
We're on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram.
Instagrams.
And we're pretty easily found there.
And there's a fun little Shockwaves group online that is always a blast.
Shockwaves fan club.
Yeah.
That's right.
Wait, so they're both then?
Yeah. All right. There's the regular Shockwaves page.
Shockwaves movie group.
Yeah.
God,
yeah,
I don't want to miss anything, guys.
That one's very active. You'd enjoy it. Shockwaves movie club.
Movie club, yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then there's the official Shockwaves page.
Well, you guys are doing a great job. I'm serious. Like, as a guy, listen, you know, as Ryan really knows, I mean, I'm a fan, you know, and
that's so
keep
cool,
it up, man.
Man,
you know.
Well, we appreciate
it. We're constant listeners instead of constant readers.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, guys.